You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
To the best of Flashpoints for the week of April 5th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we feature an interview with best-selling author and investigative journalist Greg Palast on Trump's potential immigration czar, Kris Kobach. Also, Pablo Alvarado of Endilon on Trump's threat to close the border. Later in the show, we speak with Teresa Romero, the first woman president of the United Farm Workers. All the straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off the show with a pair of interviews from Wednesday's program. The first with Greg Palast on Trump's potential immigration czar, Kris Kobach. And after that, Pablo Alvarado of Endilon on Trump's threat to close the border.
We're number one when it comes to guns and protecting elections, and I'll take that any day.
And you're the guy behind the cross checklist.
So you will vote again, you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not for Kris Kobach.
And you're listening to Flashpoints. We welcome back for our special edition of the Election Crimes Bulletin, Greg Palast. It is interesting, the now potential new first czar for immigration, Kris Kobach, was reflecting yesterday at Fox Business News Channel with Lou Dobbs that the government should use the thousands of empty mobile trailers it currently owns to create a processing town. He later referred to it as camps. Greg Palast, welcome back to Flashpoints. Camps?
Yeah, the Stalag 17 camps. Okay. Welcome to the fantastical world of Kris Kobach, who may be immigration czar. And I want to remind you, czar is not a position in any democracy. It's only not elected, but the trick that Trump is trying to pull off, he really wanted this guy to head Homeland Security. But his staff and Republican leadership warned him off against Kris Kobach for his known white supremacist views and actions and his vote thieving. You know, he was Trump's vote thief in chief, but he earned no friends in the GOP when he actually stole his own election. He was Secretary of State of Kansas, ran for governor in the GOP primary, and was the suspicious winner of that primary. The result is that a big chunk of the GOP bolted, and a Democratic governor was elected in Kansas. So he's not beloved in even Republican circles. The result is that he could never get confirmed by our Senate as the Constitution requires. So we create an unconstitutional position called a czar. And it's super dangerous because not only would have been dangerous enough if you're head of Homeland Security, but he is also now going to be above Homeland Security as the czar, but he'll also have control of any issues dealing with immigration, or supposedly just immigration, from the Defense Department. Remember, they're using defense money to build the wall. The Defense Department, deployment of troops at the border, Health and Human Services, the Census Bureau, and we'll discuss why that is particularly dangerous, the State Department and other agencies. This is a very dangerous thing to happen, and I believe, while it's really bad news for immigrants, it is particularly bad news for democracy because the real agenda of Kris Kobach is to basically be in a position where he can bend the election of 2020. This is really the hidden new scheme for vote suppression on a mass scale in 2020.
I think it's in point. Every time we really talk about him, I think it's crucial that we make the point that he really is a structural, serial white supremacist. He ain't no dummy. And he's used all that education from Oxford and wherever the hell he went to structurally attempt to change history and to support white supremacy. He helped them in Arizona, right? He was the guy behind the scenes creating those outrageous laws.
I want people to understand, we're not just throwing names around. He was the counsel for a group called FAIR. FAIR's founder said the purpose of that organization is to maintain, this is a quote, to maintain a European majority in America. That's specifically its goal, to maintain a European majority. And I don't think by European that involves Mexico. This is very much, and all of his activities have been aimed towards reducing the votes of voters of color and reducing the rights of citizens of color, let alone immigrants. He's also been at the extreme end. And when we talk about racism, for example, he did go to Yale, Harvard, and Oxford. He is no dummy. He's dangerous. And he was a lawyer for Joe Arpaio, one of the only officials since the bad old days of segregation. He worked with Joe Arpaio. Arpaio is one of the few officials to have actually been found criminally guilty of official racial discrimination. It was, in fact, the abuse of the what the ACLU calls the driving while brown laws, written by Chris Kobach, which says that a cop can pull over someone on, quote, suspicion of being an illegal immigrant. Suspicion. So what does an illegal immigrant look like in a car going 60 miles an hour? As we found out, in practice, it meant he was stopping a lot of people with a lot of brown-skinned people and demanding that they require, this was Chris Kobach's idea, that everyone, but it ended up being just brown folk, have to carry with them proof of citizenship, which is pretty difficult because we're not Red China. We don't have proof of citizenship cards in America. So you'd have to carry like either a passport, which, as we know, is kind of a white, rich travel document, or your original birth certificate. How many people carry those around with them? You probably shouldn't. Even the U.S. Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, said this was completely unconstitutional, racist. One of many, many laws written by Kobach, which have been struck down as racist and unconstitutional on its face. So this is the man who treats the Constitution like a doormat that would become this massively powerful position. And as I say, the real danger is using the post. Basically, he's been open about this for racial vote suppression tactics.
Wow. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Greg Palast. Greg has a piece up at Nation of Change. It's probably up at gregpalast.com now as well. I'm not sure. But it's about the fact that the former Secretary of State for Kansas, Chris Kobach, he ran for governor. He lost, but he did campaign on a Jeep with a machine gun. This guy is now maybe tapped. He is one of two people being considered, maybe tapped to be the first immigration czar. And this guy really has credentials as an active and effective white supremacist. Now, it isn't, the final decision hasn't been made. Could we be saved, Greg? Is there a, I think they have a runner-up here or somebody else they're considering?
There are two things. Yeah, first of all, he could never get confirmed in the Senate because you'd have even his own state's senators from Kansas would probably never allow him to have that authority. Because the GOP of Kansas despises him because he wrecked the party through his antics. And there's some people in the GOP are really worried that changing demographics of America means that if you take a man who's been openly racist in his policies and actions, and that's a demographic suicide for the GOP. But the thing is, there is a runner-up, not too much comfort there. His name is Cuccinelli. That's the guy who lost for governor of Georgia because he was considered, his positions were considered so right-wing and odious. And the two of them have worked together. Chris Kobach, when he wrote SB 1070 and the courts knocked it down as unconstitutional, he did get a couple of right-wing attorneys general to back him. Now, not his own state, Kansas State Attorney General, a Republican, refused to write a friend of the court brief on SB 1070. He found his own Secretary of State position odious. However, this guy Cuccinelli, who was Attorney General of Virginia, did write a friend of the court brief saying, yeah, stop brown people and demand their papers. That's perfectly constitutional. So the runner-up may not be such a headliner, a white supremacist. He's just kind of I wouldn't call him Kobach Light. He's more like Kobach Jr. So there's no safety there. Of course, the whole idea can be canned, but it's very clear that Trump has been trying to get a position for Kobach. First, to put him in Homeland Security. That was vetoed, we know from inside information, by Flynn, of all people, said didn't want this dangerous guy in Homeland Security. Trump made him the head of his so-called voter fraud commission. They couldn't find any fraudulent voters in America, and it imploded under its own absurdity. So he's always trying to find Kobach a position, and Kobach's always throwing ideas at him. Kobach, for example, who if you see the film The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, he's kind of the star. He's the Moriarty to my Holmes. And he's the guy, and he even called me and told me and confirmed that he was the guy who told Donald Trump to say that Mexico will pay for the wall. That was a Kobach scheme. Besides SB 1070, and now he's also this guy with the little kind of concentration camp towns for immigrants. The other thing that he is infamous for is he's the guy who said the Census Bureau, he told Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary, and he now has authority to virtually order it, but Ross is happy to go along, order the Census Bureau to ask if you are an alien, and if there's any aliens in your house, and this is the idea of doing – it has two purposes. One is to scare especially the Hispanic and Asian community into not answering the census. This will shrink their congressional districts, shrink the money that goes in their districts, shrink their state legislative districts. So it's a way to disempower and gerrymander the voters of color, especially who had come from immigrant families or have immigrants in their household. The second thing, and Kobach was straight up front about it, he wants to use the Census Bureau information that's gathered by this question to remove people from the voter rolls. Now, this is dangerous, unbelievably dangerous stuff. So in other words, by the way, that's another thing that will scare people away from filling out census forms. It threatens your right to vote. So what he wants to do is, we know this is the guy who is also, I should say, behind the interstate cross-check system, in which he supposedly found people registered in two states, mostly, again, voters of color, removing people with common names. 538 guys named James Brown in Georgia lost their vote because Chris Kobach gave Brian Kemp a list of 538 guys in other states with the name James Brown. Most had different middle names, but they ignored that.
Greg, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're just about out of time, but I wanted to bring you back. We're back to doing our election crimes bulletin weekly bulletins, but this was obviously a big story, so we wanted to jam it in and let people know that beware, the man could be coming back. But obviously there's more to come. People can check your article at Nation of Change. They can go to GregPalace.com and check out more of what you're thinking about in this context. And we look forward to finding out more next week.
You got it, Dennis.
All right. Bye. Thank you, Greg. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up next, very short musical break, and then Pablo Alvarado talking about the serial racism of the Trump administration, the impact on undocumented workers, and he also gets into Chris Kobach. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, Congress must get together, says the President of the United States, Donald Trump, and immediately eliminate the loopholes at the border. If no action, border or large sections of border will close. This is a national emergency. I'm not kidding around, says the President. Pablo Alvarado, you represent thousands of folks who are directly being hurt and undermined by the policies of the current administration at the moment. You want to respond to the latest sort of kids under the bridge, close down the border, put the military there. Give us a sense of what life is like on the front line in the face of this.
Well, I think President Trump is right in terms of when he says that there are loopholes. The loopholes that working people see, though, that immigrants and immigrant rights activists see are different than the loopholes that he sees. The loopholes that he sees are loopholes that have been invented by white supremacists, by the politics of fear, by the politics of racial injustice. Those are the loopholes that they believe that they want to close. They don't want more undocumented people who are non-white. They want to make sure that the white population in our country continues to enjoy the status of a majority and all the privileges and benefits that come with it. That is the aim of the loopholes that President Trump wants to close. The loopholes from our angle include, for instance, the fact that every day there are 11 million undocumented immigrants who toil in the fields, who work in the restaurants, who make the beds in the most luxurious hotels that you can think of, and they are not being recognized and they're being denied justice and equality. That is a big loophole that needs to be filled. The second loophole that needs to be filled is that the intervention, the foreign policy of the United States towards Central America. For years, the relationship has been, here's the aid, and the aid is destined to buy more guns, to buy more surveillance equipment, to train more police officers. It's not to improve wages and working conditions, to improve the economy of those countries. It's not to make sure that the institutions that administer justice, that the electoral authorities in those countries are fully democratic, that there's a court system that is independent and that it administers justice for rich and the poor. Those are the loopholes that I think that the United States, if they wanted to, could help actually close in the Northern Triangle. And guess what? If they help close those gaps, those loopholes, then people will migrate less. And the idea will be that migration becomes an option and not the only solution that impoverished communities sees as a way out of poverty in those countries. You know, so depending on where you see it, those are the loopholes that you need to close. And I believe that the loopholes that Mr. Trump is talking about are going to make the situation worse. And by the way, it already is an invented crisis. The reality is that people have been migrating for years, you know, and this time around they have to do it out because that's the way they protect themselves. And, you know, people who are in vulnerable circumstances simply don't have the luxury, the resources to subsidize their own trip up north. So that's why they choose to do it this way. You know, so it is an invented crisis. It's like same as the idea of the concept of illegality, the concept of the illegal alien criminal. This is an invented term, and it's more a tactic than them being worried about the concept of illegality. The reality is that this segment of right-wing extremists, anti-immigrant extremists, they hate not just undocumented people. They don't like naturalized citizens like me. They don't like TPS holders. They don't like legal permanent residents. Unless they come in from countries like Norway, you know, and for as long as they don't come from what they refer to as, shithole countries, they're welcome. So these are some of the realities that we're facing. So this idea of illegality, they're not really, really interested in public safety. If they were interested in public safety, then they would protect undocumented people. They will protect people who are in vulnerable circumstances.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Pablo Alvarado. He is the executive director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network. That's Endelon. And they represent thousands of workers, undocumented workers across this country who do the hardest work and ultimately get brutalized, undermined, threatened with deportation, deported, beaten, have their wages stolen, you name it. It's a battle to protect these folks who do the hardest work. Now, I don't imagine you were all that happy, Pablo Alvarado, to hear that the President of the United States is considering appointing Chris Kobach, the former Secretary of State. He lost. He was running for governor to be the next immigration czar. Your thoughts on this serial white supremacist being put into that position?
It doesn't surprise me because this is unfortunate. The voices of people of white supremacists like Chris Kobach, Stephen Miller, Stephen Bannon, were voices that were marginal a few years ago before Trump ascended to power. And there were more moderate Republican voices, right-wing voices that were out there. Well, though all of those voices have been effectively suppressed by this segment of people, of anti-immigrant, of xenophobes, and nativists that have effectively taken not just the Republican Party over, but the federal government. And they are in power in ways that they see the opportunity to unleash the agenda of exclusion and hatred, not just of immigrants, but people of color. That's why the attacks are not just against immigrants. It's about voter suppression. It's about, suppressing women's rights, limiting the rights of the LGBTQ community. It's not just about immigrants. It's bigotry at its greatest expression. So it doesn't surprise me that President Trump has chosen the man who has become a symbol of hatred towards immigrants, the man who is responsible for the most nefarious, for the most grotesque anti-immigrant policies. This is the guy who has defined the blueprints for anti-immigrant legislation across the country. This is the guy who has openly been promoting the idea of making the life of migrants so miserable so that people would actually get desperate and pack their own luggage and leave on their own. This is the guy who has been promoting the idea of self-deportation for many, many, many years now. And this is the person they plan to put as head of all the immigration initiatives of this administration. It is nefarious. and it's going to have a negative impact, obviously, in the immigrant community, as it as this person will actually use the infrastructure of the federal government to persecute. To persecute people who are cleaning bathrooms, people who are building homes, people who keep the garden green, the houses painted, people who take care of kids, people who prepare the beds in the hotel, people who serve in the restaurant. These are the people that are going to be under, are already under siege, but with this person and the entire infrastructure of the federal government at his disposal, imagine the harm that this person is going to cause to our community. But I can tell you for sure that hatred is not going to go unchallenged, that people will fight back and will use the court system, will fight in the streets, will fight in the halls of Congress, in every city hall in this country, and our police positions. We're going to fight everywhere, and we're not only going to win in court the way we are winning in most of the cases, because the court is aligning with immigrants in this moment. So we're not only going to win in court because the initiatives that these fellows are promoting are unconstitutional, but we're also going to win in the court of public opinion, because America is actually better than Chris College. America is not about exclusion. It's about inclusion. The values that promote the highest sentiments of humanity always prevail, and the struggle of humble people always prevail, because it's ahistorical what they are doing. These are moments in history that we've lived in the past that have only led to more turbulence in society, to more divisions, to more polarization. And that is not good for the country. And I know that there are enough voices in America to reject that type of politics.
Well, he certainly was rejected in Kansas when he ran for governor, even though it was on the stump. I guess he was in a Jeep with a machine gun or something. I don't know, exactly. But that didn't seem to work for him. But
It doesn't work because, as I said, Americans rise above this kind of mistreatment. They understand. They have seen it. This country has gone through slavery, to Jim Crow, to segregation, incredible hardships that people of color have been put under in the past, and people fought back, and guess what? A significant segment of white America understands that excluding people will only debilitate the country, will make our country weaker, not stronger.
Pablo Alvarado, I want to ask you about, you are from El Salvador, our president of the United States, or somebody's president of the United States. Donald Trump has now decided he wants to cut off aid to El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. Apparently, the folks in those countries aren't suffering enough based on a history of terrible U.S. And dangerous U.S. policy. But what kind of impact do you suppose that cutoff would have in El Salvador?
Well, look, I mean, there are good investments that the United States makes in some of the countries. For example, I know that there is Fomilenio in El Salvador, which is allowing El Salvador to build a better system of highways, a better infrastructure. So those funds have been so useful for El Salvador. And believe me, if you compare El Salvador with the infrastructure in Honduras and in Guatemala, El Salvador is doing a little better. And that's why, you know, the number of migrants living in El Salvador is less than the number of migrants living from Honduras. There are still many problems in El Salvador. But there is also a substantial assistance that one could think is not necessarily making things better. So the vast majority of resources that the United States invests in the Central American countries has been for more guns, to train the military, to train police officers, to pay for more police officers, for surveillance equipment. It's all about national security. So as I said, the investment in job creation, in the training of workers, in improving wages and working conditions so that people can actually earn what they deserve, to feed their loved ones, to feed their families so that they don't have to migrate, that kind of investment is not being made in the way it should be made right now. If the interest really was to improve circumstances so that workers wouldn't migrate, because the people who are migrated are the most disenfranchised, the most impoverished, the most the poorest, not just of those countries, but the poorest of the continent who are migrating. So if you make it better, if you lift the standards, the working conditions and wages for those people, then they're going to migrate less, you know. Ultimately, you know, people leave again, you know, migration is actually in great part governed by the dynamics of supply and demand. So for as long as there is a situation of crisis in the countries and there is a demand in a neighboring country, people will actually go to those places to seek for opportunities. So it's very simple. I mean, if they were to invest in job creation, employment generation, and it's not just bringing more maquilas to El Salvador, you know, because you need businesses that are going to respect workers' rights, that are going to pay good wages and offer good working conditions if you really want to make it better, you know. And the second thing, like, I haven't seen much investment is in making, you know, for example, the electoral authorities more efficient and to ensure that they don't commit fraud in the elections. That's exactly what happened in Honduras. If the investment was in a system that is reliable and that is fair, transparent, you know, that would be a better investment. Stability, political instability is also a cause for why people migrate from those countries when there is persecution. So the investment has to be not just economic, it has to be to consolidate democracy, you know, and you know, and help these countries to promote politics of inclusion. Now, these countries are also, the governments in these places are also responsible for what is happening. They have adopted, you know, the same neoliberal policies of privatizing, you know, that many other countries have adopted. And that has not resulted in what they call trickle-down economics. It has not helped workers. It has, you know, it has made powerful more powerful and richer. So these type of policies don't necessarily work, and these countries have been forced to adopt this, this you know, way of development, and it hasn't really worked out. So there's got to be a rethinking of the whole thing, you know. And by the way, I believe that, you know, now that the United States has effectively cut the funding, and it's probably going to be funding that goes to police departments, to gun, to buy, for them to buy guns and surveillance equipment, et cetera, for those kind of national security programs. Now that they're not going to have these funds, I mean, Salvadorans, Hondurans, and Guatemalans are going to have to figure out how they police themselves. I think it's important that the people in those countries take ownership over those systems of security. You know, we all need to be safe. We all have the need to feel safe. And when the government, all governments fail to do that, then it's time for the community to come together and start, you know, pushing back, engaging youth in programs, making sure that people have avenues to participate, and to particularly the young people, to take them away from violence. And communities can actually do a lot. So I think that this moment where resources are going to be scarce is a moment for those countries to figure out what can be done with what they have, you know? Because if they build something based on their own standing, then no one can come in and tell them that doesn't work, because they've done it themselves.
Well, that sounds like very good advice to leave with Pablo Alvarado. I guess there's all kinds of things planning. I know that you're not going to be sitting still while Chris Kobach and the rest of the supremacists try and do whatever they want to do. So the battle continues. If people want to follow up and find out more information about MDLON, what's the best way to do that?
Visit our website, www.mdlon.org. MDLON.org, and starting on May 1st, people can follow the Nuestra Voz, Our Voice, Day Labor Radio on Internet, on Facebook, YouTube Live. The Nuestra Voz Radio Jornalera, Our Voice, the Day Labor Radio, will start airing on May 1st. So people will have an opportunity to also, listen to Day Labor Voices through Radio Jornalera.
Will that be a podcast? Is that going to be a podcast? Or how will people be listening to it? Right on the web?
It's going to be YouTube Live. It's going to be Facebook Live, Instagram. And there will be an application that people will be able to download in their electronic devices. And also, there will be, for those that don't have access to internet in their phone, they will be able to call in with the phone and then access the stream through their phones. So eventually, we plan to have the antenna. But for now, the Day Labor Voices will be heard on social media,
right,
on all those platforms.
We're going to see if we can do a little rebroadcast of some of that material. We thank you for joining us on Flashpoints, and we will be in touch. Thank you, Pablo.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints for the week of April 5th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature an interview from Thursday's show with Teresa Romero, the first woman president of the United Farm Workers.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are honored and happy to be joined by Teresa Romero. She is the new president of the United Farm Workers. Picking up where Arturo left off, we have been interviewing the former president for, about 15 years now. And now we've got the next generation, and we're delighted. Teresa Romero, welcome. You're the first woman leader of the United Farm Workers. How's it feel?
Dennis, it is an amazing opportunity for me. I am very honored. And, when I think about not only I am the first woman president of the UFW, but I'm actually also the first Latina woman that is president of a national labor union. So I am very proud.
Congratulations. Well, let's start here. Sunday would have been the 90th birthday of Cesar Chavez. Unfortunately, he died early at 56 or 57 years old. But the spirit of his work obviously continues now with the UFWs. But what did you do? How did you celebrate his 90th?
Actually, it would have been his 92nd
birthday.
92nd.
Wow.
92nd, yes. And we had the opportunity. I was in Salinas. And we had a march where we had hundreds of people joining us and celebrating and commemorating his birth. And, of course, out of respect for his legacy, which lives on today.
And where did that take place? It was a march. How was it attended? Were people excited?
Oh, absolutely. It was in Salinas. It was at the Cesar Chavez Park, of course. And I would say we have over 1,000 people. Very excited, very, very proud to be there. And, of course, we did it to honor his legacy, his birthday, and also to for people to learn and promote the blue card, which would give legal residency to farm workers and their families.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about women in the fields, the role that women can play now. We do know, I guess you would assert, that women are just as capable as men for working in the fields, right?
Absolutely. I have been visiting the field for many years since I started with the union, and I have the opportunity to work with farm workers. And when I talk to women, it is like in any field. They do their very physical and hard work in the fields, and then they go back home and they play the role of mother and wife, ensuring the kids eat, the kids do homework, getting them ready for the next day. So they still have that dual responsibility after a very hardworking day.
But they can do the work. They also sort of face a double or triple jeopardy in terms of harassment in the fields, and particularly if the women are undocumented, they're more vulnerable. You want to talk about the kinds of struggles women have at that level and how you plan to support them and work with them and make sure that they are protected?
It is unfortunately very true. We encounter this day in and day out. And that's one of the most difficult things for women to talk about. So we're working and empowering them and giving them a voice. To me, the most important thing is that farm workers have a voice. And in this specific case, women, where they feel that nobody may believe them, or that they might be fired from the work, or there might be retaliation. So it is not an easy path. The Me Too movement is not just in Hollywood. You know, it happens everywhere, and these are especially very vulnerable women. But we are working, and one of the things that we're trying to do and that we've been very successful on is engaging everybody in the supply chain, including the retailers, making them aware, knowing what is happening in their supply chain. So I think it's a process that we have been working on for a few years, but it's very becoming successful because it's allowing everybody to understand and take action as to what's happening in the field and is happening to these women.
We are speaking to the new president of the United Farm Workers, Teresa Romero. We're talking about, among other things, the role of women in the fields as farm workers. Just to make sure we keep a human face on this, could you give us a few examples, perhaps, that you've witnessed or that you know about, the ways in which women have been undermined, attacked, abused? Just give us a sense of that so people understand the importance and the urgency of it.
Many of the women that are undocumented, and not only women, but farm workers in the field, are afraid to speak. And we are currently, in this case, working with some dairy women and dairy workers in the Pacific Northwest that have been not only abused, but retaliated against. We had the case of a woman that I've spoken with several times and met with several times, where she was working at a dairy, and she was sexually harassed for a long time. And not only so, she was sexually harassed, she was sexually harassed in front of her husband, who worked with her. Wow. And they both had to be quiet because they knew that they would be fired if they spoke up and they had a family to support, which is exactly what happened when she spoke up, when she reported it. Not only was she fired, her harasser kept his job and was promoted. So, and I talked to many women that shared the same issues. And I'm afraid to speak. And it's a combination of how difficult it is to talk about sexual harassment, but also the fear of their legal status. So it's an uphill battle, but we're working with these women.
Do you think that the fact, I'm just going to say it straight up, that Donald Trump is not only somebody who disrespects women, but he's a serial racist, and the kinds of policies he is bringing down against brown people, would you say has made them and the community you represent more vulnerable?
Absolutely. More vulnerable, more people are being arrested just on their way to work, on their way to take their children to school. I've spoken with farm workers who tell me that in the past, they would worry about their legal status. They would worry if they run a red light, what would happen. But now they worry that they're just driving down the street and that might be stopped. And the worst part of it is that now they have to tell their young children, 5, 6, 7 years old, what it is that they need to do if their parents don't come home. So the children get up and go to school every morning, not knowing if their parents would be home at the end of the day. And that is just cruel, and that it is definitely as a direct result of the current administration's position on immigration and immigrants in general.
Are there examples of situations that you know of where just that happened, parents with their kids on the way to school never quite make it to the schoolhouse, or the kids end up in school, but the parents end up in some kind of cold refrigerator prison or somehow being detained?
Yes, parents have been detained at school when the kid, in
at
front
school.
Of the kids. Well, where are they dropping them off? A year ago, there was a case of a couple who farm workers who were driving looking for work, and they started the work. Stopped or tried to be stopped by ICE. Their fear, unfortunately, made them try to run away. They lost control of the vehicle, and they both died.
They both died.
Leaving a family of six children from between the ages of 8 and 18 years old. And not only that, the 18-year-old is trying to help raise her brothers and sisters. The uncle, who had a four-child of his own and who was trying to help his family, was targeted by immigration and deported shortly after these children's parents were killed.
After they were killed, they targeted the uncle.
Yes. And, you know, we need to remember, these are hardworking people. They are professionals of the fields. A lot of people think that field work is just manual work, labor work, and it is very specialized. These workers understand different crops, what to do, how to do it. So now it's not only a very difficult physical work, but it takes a lot of knowledge. They're professionals. They contribute to these societies. They contribute to our economy. They put food on our tables. So it is. They're being demonized. We immigrants are being demonized. And we work very hard to earn what we have.
That's a very important we, because your own background gives you a lot of experience, not only in terms of the Spanish-speaking world, but the indigenous communities. I understand now that under your leadership, I think you're going to have to start making contracts not only in Spanish and English, but in the indigenous languages, because there are many more folks who are participating now. Is that right?
Absolutely. We have many works from Oaxaca, which is the south of Mexico, and they speak, in Oaxaca, there's different Indian tribes that speak, you know, many, many different tongues. I myself, I'm from Zapotecan descent. My grandmother on my mother's side, I was a Zapotecan Indian who did not speak Spanish when she got married. Her native tongue was Zapotecan. And I am encountering here many indigenous people that, yes, they speak different tongues, and we are going to, we're adjusting and adapting to be able to meet their needs, because it is more difficult to them. They don't speak either Spanish or English. So we're making the efforts to help them in their own language, and the issues that they dealing with, the issues that they have. They're very hardworking. They're very tenacious. And most of them make a big effort and speak Spanish. So it is, they don't give up. They definitely have the si se puede attitude.
Speaking of si se puede attitude, you have been very busy on the cutting edge. Let's talk a little bit about the kinds of legislation you've been working on, some of the successes and some of the things coming up in terms of where the next battles are. I know there's a bunch of stuff happening in Congress. You want to talk about that?
Yes, actually, I was in Sacramento the last couple of days, because we are supporting and sponsoring a bill by Assemblymember Robert Rivas that is going to help us build adequate housing for farm workers. The current housing for farm workers is deplorable. Their income is such that maybe two or three families are living in a two-bedroom apartment, or their housing is completely dilapidated and unsafe. So yesterday and the day before yesterday, I was in Sacramento, and that bill passed committee. So it is a first victory. We have also, like I mentioned, the immigration reform bill, which was introduced by Senator Feinstein and Congresswoman Loughran, and that we are sponsoring. As you know, over time, passed in California and now farm workers are going to be entitled to overtime in California, which is something that many people don't know, but farm workers were specifically excluded from those provisions of the law. And starting this year, it's going to be phased out, but starting this year, they're going to start earning overtime after 9.5 hours of work in one day.
That's a big thing, right? That overtime, that's been a huge battle since, what, 1946 or?
1938. Yes, it has been a big battle. And we tried many times and finally succeeded, and now we are doing
it. Because farm workers were excluded, just to be clear, farm workers were effectively, legislatively excluded from getting overtime pay, right? I don't even know what the justification could be for that.
That is correct. The justification at the time was the workers that were in the fields were either were minorities, were Latinos, were immigrants, and were African Americans. So it was a decision that African Americans and people of color should not be making the same as white people, and specifically excluded, and throughout the country, not only in California.
Wow. So now what's happening on that front? The overtime, the bill has passed, or where is that?
In California, it has passed. It has been introduced at the federal level. It has to go out of committees, and it's going to be a long process. It is going to be an uphill battle like it was here. But we do believe that we do not give up. As it took us a long time to pass heat illness protections and overtime here in California, we're going to keep trying at the federal level because it is the right thing to do. And for those who oppose it, for those who vote against it, for those who think that farm workers don't deserve it, shame on them.
Shame on them. Some of the folks who do the hardest work in this country that oftentimes make it possible for people to have very beautiful and very full dinner tables. And over many years, even though these folks are responsible for putting the food on the table, they couldn't even afford to buy it. That's a major thing you've been working on, right? And the UFW has been working on.
Absolutely. It is sometimes sad that the very difficult work that they do every day to produce or to harvest our fruits and vegetables that we all enjoy in every household, sometimes they cannot afford to buy. And the UFW has always done work not only in collective bargaining, because we know that there are many other needs that farm workers have. So that's why we engaged in legislative work. We have our medical plan that has paid between the medical plan and the pension plan, and over $500 million in benefits to members. So these are things that benefit, help our members. The legislative work that we do not only helps our members, but helps every single farm worker in California. And if we are successful, or should I say, when we are successful in immigration, it is going to affect every farm worker in this country.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are delighted to be joined by Teresa Romero. She's the new president of the United Farm Workers, the first woman president of the United Farm Workers. There's actually only been three. There was Cesar Chavez, who founded it, then Arturo Rodriguez, who we have interviewed many times, who was the lead for some 25 years, and now we have Teresa Romero. And maybe a good place to wrap the interview up is that there have been successes. I know that as you marched and celebrated the United Farm Workers over the weekend and Cesar's 92nd birthday, there were also agreements to celebrate and new relationships with corporations that demonstrate that there is a future that's possible in terms of working with humane bosses who understand the plight and the needs of the folks who do the hardest work in this country. Your thoughts on that information?
You know, we have learned that in order to have a bigger impact, we need to include the entire supply chain. from the field where the farm workers are, understand and know what the issues are, to the consumers. And we have engaged some of our contract companies and have worked in a very collaborative relationship to for the benefit of everybody, not just the farm workers, but the farms themselves. And we have included major buyers like Costco, who has been an amazing supporter of the work that we're doing. And in this case, these stores like Costco, these buyers like Costco, have agreed to pay a premium to growers who follow certain standards of how to treat the people, how to pay their people, the safety. I mean, and it is one of the ways that we can impact the people that we represent, but also have a buy-in from the buyers, who they're committed to financially reward these growers, and part of this premium goes directly to the farm workers.
Well, all right. What comes next? Where are you going today? What's on your agenda this week? Give us a sense of the sort of the resistance that the UFW is offering in the face of a president who has demonstrated a disdain, if not an outright hate and distrust for brown and black people in this country.
What we do is we constantly, you know, our first lady say, when they go low, we go high. And that's all he does. He keeps going low. So our approach, it is continue the work that we're doing through collective bargaining, special programs, and legislative work to be able to impact the people that really deserve it. His actions and his denial for the contributions of farm workers and immigrants in general are going to be something that he is going to at one point answer for. But we're continuing to work, doing the work. We're not changing what we do. We're not changing how we do it. If anything, we're more energized to keep fighting for the people that we represent. But again, when they go low, we go high.
And the final question, and I just want to get your gut reaction to the extraordinary measures that Trump has taken in terms of breaking up families, hiding, disappearing, if you will, thousands of children. Your thoughts on this policy, which is continuing. I mean, let me just say that Trump is talking about this guy, Chris Kobach, the former Secretary of State of Kansas, who is a declared a racist, who is a structural racist, who does not want brown or black people in this country.
It is despicable. It is inhumane. It is something that I don't think has any understanding of the suffering that he's causing, because he is very far removed. And it is something, he is creating a long lasting pain and suffering for these families. These children who have not been reunited with their families are going to grow up thinking, if they ever reunited with his families, they may not, are going to grow up thinking they were abandoned. But it is one person who is creating these emotional scars for these children, the horrible pain for the parents, and the humiliating conditions under which they are being held. And there is only one person responsible for that, and that's Donald Trump.
All right. Well, we know that you're responsible now, Teresa Romero, for the United Farm Workers, for leading that organization into the 21st century. We wish you the best. We send you congratulations. And we really do appreciate you taking the time out to speak with us and our audience on Pacifica Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Be careful now. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you, Dennis. Bye-bye.
That does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at DennisJBernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, a brilliant and hard-hitting speech by Chris Hedges. The system cannot be fixed, and only a revolution of a sort can save us the people, says Hedges. I hope you'll stay tuned. August 2016. And here we are, late in an election campaign that is leaving a bad taste in everybody's mouth. Near as I can see, almost nobody wants Hillary Clinton to be president, and few want Donald Trump. The establishment-controlled, corporate-owned news media are not even going to mention Green Party candidate Jill Stein. My very rough estimate is that Stein has more enthusiastic supporters than Hillary Clinton does. If the United States were actually a democracy, Stein would have some shot at winning. Of course, if we actually were a democracy, the Democratic Party would have nominated Bernie Sanders. Instead, the Democrats offer us the corporate-sponsored child of Wall Street, Hillary R. Clinton, Mitt Romney in lipstick and a necklace. We'll get to transgender bathrooms later. Chris Hedges has a few caustic things to say about both the conservative Republican candidate, that is, Hillary Clinton, and her former opponent, the liberal Democrat Bernie Sanders. About Mr. Trump, he says very little, except this. This is what you get when an oligarchy oppresses, squeezes, and stresses the common people to the very limit and beyond. He saw the same thing happen in Yugoslavia. At least Donald Trump is easier to pronounce than Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic. These days, we need the radical imagination and radical voices more than ever. We need to get away from all the superficial conflicts, the trivia, the meaningless sensationalism that the establishment wants to distract you with. The people who own and run our country do not want you to think seriously about our $1 trillion annual military spending. They do not want you to think about our policy of eternal, unending war. Or about climate change, unaffordable health care, massive unemployment, and a government of, by, and for the fat cats that pay for it. No, the powers that be, through the mass media that they own, would like you to focus instead on Hillary's emails, the Olympics, the Kardashians, and which bathroom transvestites should use. We need radical voices and radical visions addressing the roots of our serious overlapping crises. That's what radical means, from the Latin for root. One of today's radical voices belongs to journalist and essayist Chris Hedges. He spoke in Seattle in April 2016 and was captured on video by Ed Mays of Pirate TV. I labored mightily, cleaning up the sound for radio broadcast, snipping out many long pauses, and cranking up the volume when Hedges' voice trails off. Yes, sound editing is dirty, thankless, wrist-breaking labor, but somebody's got to do it. It's no worse than picking tomatoes in Immokalee, Florida. But enough maudlin self-pity. Hedges titled his talk, The Algebra of Revolution, and we shall hear it, God willing, this week and next. Here is part one.
Obviously, tonight I'm going to look at the political morass that we have fallen into and examine the insurgent candidates, Trump and Sanders, what that means. For the last 10 years, I've been not just writing about, but reporting on the malaise of American society. 2 years with the Christian right in megachurches across the country, an examination of the American liberal establishment and what has happened to it in death of the liberal class, empire of illusion, the end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle. It's how you get a reality star like Trump as a viable presidential candidate. Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt with the great Joe Sacco. Again, we spent 2 years on that book, traveling to the poorest pockets of the United States to look at the nature of unfettered, unregulated capitalism, what it does in these sacrifice zones, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, second poorest county in the United States, where the average male has a life expectancy of 48, that is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti, where at any one time 80% of the residents have neither electricity or running water. This is America. Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in America, and not surprisingly, the year we were there, per capita the most dangerous city in America in terms of homicides. Coal fields of southern West Virginia, produce fields in Immokalee, Florida. The point of that book being that it's incumbent upon all of us to look at these sacrifice zones, these places that were sacrificed first by corporate power, corporate interests, because we've all become a sacrifice zone. And of course, my last book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt, where I write that the most pressing existential crisis of our time is to grasp what lies before us, in particular the effects of climate change, and yet resist anyway. That rebellion has a moral imperative. I was arrested last week in front of the Capitol for Democracy Spring. And so that 10-year period when I came back from overseas, where I had covered disintegrating societies, whether in the former Yugoslavia, I covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe. And because I had reported on that process day by day, I brought that body of experience back into the United States and went out into my own country, in many ways a foreign country to me after a 20-year absence. And what has now appeared before us are many of the symptoms, visible symptoms of a society in deep, and one could even argue perhaps terminal, decay. And as all of you who, like me, read climate change reports, you know we have no time left. In Death of the Liberal Class, I talk a lot about that process by which our radical movements opened up the space in American democracy. Howard Zinn, of course, makes this point in The People's History of the United States. One of the advantages of teaching in a post-literate society is that when I submit my reading list to the prison authorities, they have no idea what are in these books. So I write up a very boring survey of American history and our three branches of government, and it gets approved, and then I give all of my students the People's History of the United States. I taught a class a year ago spring called Conquest, and I used Eduardo Galeano's Open Veins of Latin America, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and C.L.R. James's Black Jacobins on the Haitian Revolution. And I'd given my students the syllabus, and there was a Wednesday that I wasn't there. I was in Montana. And I got a phone call in the hotel room, and they said, this is the Special Investigations Division of the Department of Corrections of the state of New Jersey. And do you know that your students just led a sit-down strike in our prison? And we think you're behind it. And so they revoked my credentials until I went in for a two-hour interrogation. And I didn't know about the sit-down strike, but in a way I was behind it, of course, because they had read those books and understood that, as Frederick Douglass says, power concedes nothing without demand. And it was very moving. It was moving and kind of got to the theme of the last book, because they all knew what was going to happen to them. You're not getting out of a prison. And their cells were searched, and they were interrogated, and they did find the leaders, the two leaders, who were immediately shipped to another prison and put in solitary confinement. But we've reached a moment in American history where those mechanisms within a capitalist democracy that had once been able to protect our basic rights and address our basic grievances have been taken from us. We've undergone, as John Ralston Saul says, a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. And in Death of the Liberal Class, I go back to World War I. The great writer Dwight MacDonald, a writer I like very much, says that World War I was the rock on which radical movements were broken. And they were broken by Woodrow Wilson, one of the darkest presidents in American history. Aside from being a racist, he created the system, first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, the Creel Commission, pioneered the understanding of crowd psychology under Le Bon, Trotter, Sigmund Freud, and others, passed the Espionage Act, the Sedition Act. And when you go back and read the radicals of that period, Randolph Bourne or Jane Addams, they decry how effective that system of mass propaganda was, which appealed, of course, to how people feel. People were not moved by facts or reason, but by that manipulation of emotion, and how effective it was in turning even socialists and the intellectual class behind the war effort. And they write with some despair. And we entered, after World War I, a period MacDonald describes as unique in modern history. And that is a culture gripped by what he calls the psychosis of permanent war. He said none of the political theorists of the 19th century, including Karl Marx, anticipated the psychosis of permanent war, where the day World War I is over, the dreaded Hun becomes the dreaded Red. And after the war, they shut down Appeal to Reason, which was a socialist journal with the fourth highest circulation in the country. They shut down the masses. They deport Emma Goldman and Berkman and other radicals in the Palmer raids. Eugene V. Debs, at this point, is already in prison and will sit in prison until, I think it's 1922. And that was the time in which these movements that had opened up our closed system, and our system was designed to be closed. You read the Federalist Papers, and there is a deep and abiding fear of direct or popular democracy, and all sorts of mechanisms put into place to prevent that possibility, including the Electoral College. That's how Al Gore gets 500,000 more votes than George W. Bush, and George W. Bush is appointed president by judicial fiat by the Supreme Court. Senators were originally appointed, and of course, at the beginning, women, African Americans, Native Americans, white men without property were all denied the vote. And so you had that struggle, long and bloody struggle, at the end of the 19th century. We had the bloodiest labor wars of any industrialized nation. Hundreds of American workers were murdered. Tens of thousands were blacklisted by vigilante groups, the Gun Thugs, the Pinkertons, the Baldwin Felts. And from the end of World War I, that past century in American history, there has been, in the name first of the war against communism, a mechanism by which the populist and radical movements that organized to open up the space, the abolitionists, the suffragists, the labor movement, were destroyed. And then, of course, after, in particular, World War II, with the McCarthy hearings, Ellen Schrecker has written two very good books on this. One on the academy, No Ivory Tower, about the purging of the universities, not just the universities, but the high schools, so that the FBI would go into high schools with a list of 4, 5, 6, 7 teachers who were communist or soft on communism or without, of course, any evidence, and they would immediately be fired and blacklisted. And the more high-profile attacks against Pete Seeger or Hollywood are known. But Schrecker points out that this was just pervasive throughout the society. The only mechanism that we have as citizens to protect our rights and defend our interests has never come through formal political parties, but through movements and organizations that never achieved positions of power, but held fast to moral imperatives. One can see it in the civil rights movement under King, where certainly until he was assassinated in April of 1968, he was one of the most powerful political forces in the country, because when he went to Memphis or Selma, 50,000 people went with him. And that mechanism by which we forced power to respond came from movements. And it was a liberal establishment that was able to ameliorate the system in such a way to mitigate the anger and the frustration. And the classic example of that is Roosevelt's New Deal, where Roosevelt writes that if his fellow oligarchs do not begin to respond to the widespread suffering, they will get revolution. That's Roosevelt. Those are Roosevelt's words. And so in essence, he tells his fellow oligarchs that it's better to give up some of your money now, or you may lose all of it. And that is how we get government created 12 million jobs, public works, Social Security. And Roosevelt, looking back, says that his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And we've forgotten that history, in large part because it's not taught the historical amnesia which has gripped the country is by design. And with the fusion of corporate and military power after World War II, because, of course, we did not demobilize the arms industry, as we did after World War I, but united it with the corporatists, who used massive amounts of federal spending to keep us, in essence, on a war footing, but also worked with the corporatists to destroy any political figure or any movement that challenged that corporate military cabal that is, I think, as Seymour Melman, the economist at Columbia, argued, disemboweled, destroyed the economy. Henry Wallace would be a good example, Roosevelt's former vice president, who ran in 48, and until McGovern was really the last figure to really rise up against the military establishment. And this, of course, something that Sanders has not done, because challenging that establishment is political suicide, which he is fully aware of. And yet at the same time, we are never going to have a society that is able to roll back these programs of austerity. We just saw a week ago a million more people erased from the welfare, from the food stamp program. It's just this slow descent. And so the radical movements were broken. In the name of anti-communism, the liberal establishments were destroyed. That's how you get a figure like Bill Clinton, both the Clintons, who create this fictional form of liberalism, and Obama is not exempt from this, where you speak in the old language of liberalism, but you betray the very constituency that you claim to represent. And I think that's what's happened in both parties. So the Republican Party has looked at nativists and right-wing Christians and anti-abortion activists and people in the gun culture as their useful idiots, and the Democrats have looked at people of color, the poor, unions, the traditional educated elite as their useful idiots. They have both essentially turned politics into anti-politics, and by that I mean the culture wars are not about politics. And so that on all of the major structural issues, whether it is the expansion of imperial power beyond our ability to sustain it, now the longest wars in U.S. history, and I speak as someone who spent 7 years in the Middle East, what do we have to show for it? Aside from the wholesale destruction of countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, the creation of failed states like Libya or ISIS, it makes no sense. But of course, there are powerful corporate interests for whom war is a great business. A Tomahawk cruise missile costs $1.1 million, and when they invaded Libya over a span of days, they dropped 500 of them. That's $500 million. The whole expansion of NATO, this makes no sense in terms of national security. We had promised Gorbachev, Reagan had promised Gorbachev with the fall of the Berlin Wall that NATO would not be expanded beyond Germany. But it's expanded because Poland and Czechoslovakia, and these are arms markets. And I think that we are seeing foreign policy virtually hijacked by corporate forces in contravention of what makes any sense, not only in terms of foreign policy, but in terms of military policy. But that has just been writ large now throughout the entire culture, the whole primacy of profit. And no society that I know of in the last few thousand years of human civilization has ever embraced the notion that the dictates of the market should determine the construction of a society itself. It is a species of utopianism. That's what neoliberalism is. It's not a rational idea. It's an ideology which, as Marx understood, serves the interests of that tiny corporate elite that profits from it. But all of the ideas that were sold to us about neoliberalism as bolstering the middle class and providing jobs and even protecting democracy, because, of course, neoliberalism is incompatible with democracy, it destroys democracy, have now been proven false across the political spectrum. And you're watching this rage, legitimate rage, rise up throughout American society. And much of that rage is being expressed, especially by a white underclass, in the traditional forms of fascism. I was in Montgomery, Alabama, with the great civil rights attorney, Brian Stevenson, who spent his life fighting on behalf of prisoners on death row, not surprisingly, most of whom are poor and black. And we were walking through Montgomery, and Brian was pointing out all the new Confederate memorials that had been put up throughout the city, all within the last 10 years, including a massive Confederate flag that flies now on the outskirts of the city. Half of Montgomery is black. It is where Dr. Martin Luther King began his ministry. It is where Rosa Parks refused to give her seat up on the bus. And before I had gotten there, a few weeks before, the Sons of the Confederacy had held a reenactment of Jefferson Davis's inaugural on the steps of the state capitol because Montgomery was the original Southern White House, Southern seat. And I said to Brian, this is exactly what I saw in Yugoslavia. That when people are pushed to such a moment of despair and hopelessness, they retreat into a mythical vision of the past, a form of magical thinking. The idea that the economic destruction of America, much of it we must lay at the feet of Bill Clinton for NAFTA, and of course they're going to vote on this new trade agreement, the TPP, in the lame duck session after the elections. The idea that persecuting Muslims or undocumented workers or homosexuals is somehow going to make America great again. But it shows the way people have unplugged themselves from the difficulties before them, the inability to grasp what's been done to them.
Chris Hedges with part one of The Algebra of Revolution. Part two next week. Thanks again to Pirate TV Seattle for the original recording, which I have polished up for radio. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Find our free archive of past shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust advising illegitimi non carborundum, the lesser of two evils is still evil, and please come back again next week. Ciao. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The government and corporate so-called mainstream media are at it again. Just like with 9/11, the government tells us its version of what's happened, which is full of holes and outright lies, and is not supported by any evidence, and the media becomes its echo chamber, no matter what the facts, no matter what the evidence is to the contrary. And as with 9/11, the Iraq War, Libya, Syria, the White Helmets, chemical attacks, and the list goes on, now they are fabricating a whole story around Venezuela. On today's show, we're going to take a look at what the facts are, what the evidence tells us about Venezuela. You can judge for yourself what's really going on and why the U.S. wants regime change there. The first thing to know is that Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves. Recently, the Venezuelan government has confirmed that it also has the world's largest gold reserves, valued at $100 billion. Those unlucky Venezuelans also have diamonds, uranium deposits, titanium, and coltan, which only seven countries in the world have. And coltan is used in cell phones, computer chips, as well as in electromagnetic instruments for aviation. Without coltan, there are no cell phones. So when you hear the U.S. government officials and the media claim that our interests in Venezuela are for humanitarian reasons, I hope you'll not be gullible enough to believe them. Here's Lee Camp on his TV show Redacted Tonight on the RT station, using humor to explain why we're in Venezuela.
So let's take a second to go over the big three things that seem to really cause the United States to want to overthrow or bring down a foreign government. If you have one of these three things, the U.S. might screw with you. If you have two of these things, the U.S. will definitely screw with you. If you have three of these things, then look behind you right now because the U.S. is currently screwing you. Number one, being a socialist country. That's right. If you don't have the same economic system as us, oh man, we will cut you. All right? Number two, dropping the U.S. dollar. Iraq dropped the dollar. Iran dropped the dollar. Libya dropped the dollar. Pakistan dropped the dollar in trade with China, and the following day, we added them to the list of countries violating religious freedom. All right? I'm not kidding. We do not take kindly to dropping the dollar. But that doesn't apply to Venezuela, no. Venezuela has never... Okay, all right. Venezuela has two out of the big three. But the number three reason we try to bring down other countries is because they have oil or other resources, and Venezuela doesn't have any of those. World's leader in oil reserves? Only the world. That's, I bet Jupiter's moon Europa has more, all right? So, in case anyone was wondering, that is why the U.S. is trying to create a coup in Venezuela right now. It is. And our government is doing it with the support of every mainstream media channel in America, from MSNBC to Fox News to NPR to Bill Maher, all right? Every single one.
And U.S. government actions regarding Venezuela are important. According to Whitney Webb in an article from Mint Press News on January 26, 2019, quote, what happens in Venezuela going forward will have major consequences for the entire region and the world. And with the U.S. already pushing countries to pick sides, the world may soon become as divided as it was immediately before World War II. But before getting into the present situation, let's go back and look at Venezuela's history a little bit. And here are George Galloway, a British politician, a former member of parliament, and Adam Gary, a geopolitical expert, to tell us a little bit more about this.
I'm George Galloway.
And I'm Adam Gary.
And together we are the History Boys, bringing you these stories. the great events and small that made up the world as it is today. Today, Adam, we can do no other than discuss the dramatic turn of events in Venezuela, where some guy in the street in Caracas has sworn himself in as the president of the republic. And an unseemly scramble is underway to recognize him. Unelected, didn't even stand for election, couldn't even claim to be the disputed victor or loser of an election, never stood in the presidential election, but has declared himself to be the president of the country with the largest oil reserves on the planet.
I'm sure those two things aren't related at all.
Entirely unrelated. Now, at the time of recording, the United States, Canada, and mighty Albania have recognized this new joker as president of Venezuela. But various personalities, Tusk and others, have indicated that the European Union is going to go down the same road. Britain has, as it last did in Cambodia when it continued to recognize Pol Pot, despite Pol Pot having zero claim to controlling the territory, which is supposed to be the British yardstick. We recognize whoever controls a particular piece of territory as the sovereign government there. What's it all about? Where did it come from? And what is the Bolivarian Revolution that Maduro stands for?
Well, the initial Bolivarian Revolution took place in the early 19th century. It was named for Simon Bolivar, a great anti-colonial leader who went against Spain. Now, some of the themes about Bolivar's life have come to haunt subsequent self-professed Bolivarian leaders, insofar as he was trying to achieve independence from his country outside of the Spanish Empire, but in order to do it, he had to rely on not only the peasants, not only the underclass, but also on local oligarchic families who he had to convince would be better off under a Republic of Venezuela than under a kingdom, an empire of Spain. A bit later, almost 100 years later, in 1902 and early 1903, Britain and Germany led a European naval blockade on Venezuela because Venezuela owed debts to various banks in the city of London, in Frankfurt, in Berlin, and other places in Europe. And ironically, very ironically, given what's happened this week in Caracas, it was a Teddy Roosevelt-run United States that said, hold your horses, pull back a bit to Europe. And the reason for this wasn't because of any great altruism, but because one, America, as in the United States, wanted their banks into Venezuela rather than those of the city of London and continental Europe. And then reason number two, America has always wanted to suck Latin America into its orbit.
It's the Monroe Doctrine, isn't it, that the Latin American subcontinent is the United States of America's backyard.
Absolutely. And even though the CIA didn't exist in any way, shape or form when President Monroe made that declaration, oh boy, has it come true in the 20th century and with an especially iron fist after 1945. We've got to remember that throughout Latin America, it was American banks that eventually superseded the European banks and American companies that run roughshod over any semblance of civilian sovereign government. Look at Central America alone, for example. This is where we get the term Banana Republic from, because it was the United Fruit Company that was powerful, 10 times more powerful than the individual supposedly sovereign governments and where the banana plantations were. This includes Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Costa Rica, and all of these countries. When the United Fruit Company said, telegrammed Washington and said, there's some leader who has this crazy idea that he wants to tax our revenue, that he wants to regulate our operations, that he wants to make us pay better than semi-slave wages to the workers, you've got to do something about it. And this led to U.S. intervention after U.S. intervention, and this is even before the CIA was invented. By the time we get to the era of the CIA, we get coups in Guatemala sponsored by the CIA, or right-wing military coups against democratic or left-wing governments. So you've got Guatemala 54 and 55. 1953, you had it in Colombia. In 64, you had a huge one in Brazil. You also had one that year in Bolivia. In 1973, you had Uruguay and then the infamous coup in Chile, which substituted Salvador Allende for Augusto Pinochet, the first 9/11, as we talked about on a previous episode. In 1976, you had the United States install the military regime, which Galtieri played a big part in and later went up against Britain in the Falklands. You had America invading Grenada in the early 1980s. You had America involved in the Nicaraguan Civil War in the 1980s, getting Iranian money involved while selling weapons to Iran's enemy, Saddam, on the other side of the earth. You had America involved in the late 70s to early 90s war in El Salvador. And so you see over and over again that just brazenly, if there's someone or something in government in any part of Latin America that someone in Washington or business interests from the U.S. doesn't like, it's really just a phone call away. And what we've seen, though, even by these standards, what we've seen this week in Caracas is extraordinary, because it's literally the United States taking the Charter of the United Nations and every other letter and spirit of international law and putting it in the place where a stray dog does his business, to put it mildly. You have someone who's taken to Twitter saying, "I'm the president," and then you have the US president taking to Twitter saying, "Yes, sir, you are." It's the Twitter coup happening in front of the entire world's eyes.
Usually they wait till the incumbent has been shot dead or has fled or is in jail before their puppet is conjured forth and recognized by the imperium. But in this case, the president is still in the presidency. His army is still loyal to him. Hundreds of thousands of people are on the streets in support of him, but someone else altogether is being addressed as Your Excellency the President. Without even, as I say, the, I suppose, cosmetic possibility that, well, he'd run in an election and it was a dispute over the result or whatever. And just in case you didn't think that the social media giant were at the service of the Imperium, Facebook withdrew the blue tick from President Maduro on the very day of Trump's pronunciamento and gave it to this guy in the street in Caracas. Ditto Twitter. Mm-hmm. They did exactly the same thing. Wikipedia has put up a picture of this guy from the street in Caracas and described him as the president of Venezuela. So you see the whole corporate machinery of the Imperium going into action against a guy, Maduro, who is manifestly still standing. Now, before they drop the bombs, of course, they drop the narrative. And this narrative about the supposed basket case of Venezuela, the bankruptcy of socialism, as if Venezuela was a socialist country, which it isn't. This has been being dropped now for years under Chavez and Maduro. They have softened up. I can only speak for the British public, but I've just been with some people who ought to know better, who imagine that Maduro has been deficient in some way in the economic problems that now beset Venezuela. But in truth, Venezuela is in economic trouble because of American sanctions, sabotage, and the American drive to keep the oil price down, precisely to cause problems for Venezuela, Russia, and Iran. Am I not right?
You're absolutely right, and I want to get into that in a second. But getting to the earlier point of the statements you were making, the history of how media is involved in international relations, this is going to be a very interesting case study, hopefully in a saner world. In the Vietnam War, the film reels, because it was film in those days, that were coming back stateside to be processed, showed a world, a war that was far uglier than the establishment wanted people to imagine. By 1990, the establishment realized that televised images don't always go in their favor, and so the Gulf War of 1990 became very staged managed. It was now live TV, satellite TV, no need for the film reels to be processed. In the Iraq War of 2003, it was much the same. I could say that about 1999 in Yugoslavia, but that was being ignored because Monica Lewinsky was, of course, in the news, while Tony Blair quietly made a speech at the University of Chicago saying that you help people by killing people, this perverse thesis that many just accept as true without questioning the illogic of it. Now, though, we've taken it a step further. The powers that be saw how during the Syria crisis, the power of individuals on social media challenging the official narrative could actually make waves. People saying, hold on, I don't think what you're saying is right. Hold on, someone on the ground has sent me this evidence which contradicts what you've got via satellite from the Holiday Inn or Marriott Hotel in Beirut from someone who's never even set foot in Syria. Getting wise to that, they've realized that you've got to control the social media narrative. And so you had the phenomenon, speaking of this guy, Juan Guaido, the fake president of Venezuela. He had the blue check mark on Twitter, was tweeting images of him swearing himself in as president in the middle of the street. But this is the extraordinary thing. On his Twitter biography, he didn't update his old job. So you now have the phenomenon where someone is being recognized throughout the Western world anyway for a stunt that he pulled without even updating his own biography on Twitter. But getting back to the economy, there's two important things. One, even if you hate someone's economic system, that doesn't give you the right to invade them. Look at Libya. Libya was a rich country when the U.S. invaded Libya. And Venezuela's a country that, of course, could be a lot richer, but it's got the problems of sanctions and artificially low oil price, something that affected many, many presidents in Venezuela, including the right wing, called a Dutch disease, when you don't diversify your export economy away from one generally valuable commodity. That's something that's infected many Venezuelan leaders, both on the right and the left. But in any case, it's as though we're living in a parallel dimension, that people actually have to justify, oh, you don't need to go to war with that country. The interest rates are actually stabilizing. What is this nonsense? You don't invade a country that hasn't invaded you. It's anathema to international law.
It's
and
the
to
ultimate
ethics.
War crime, making aggressive war. Was adjudged at Nuremberg to be the ultimate crime.
And again, that was the History Boys, former member of British Parliament George Galloway and geopolitical expert Adam Gary, discussing their ideas on Venezuela. It has been lightly edited, but you can find the full version on YouTube under the History Boys, if YouTube hasn't censored it yet. So to recap, Venezuela has oil, gold, and other sought-after resources. And it also dropped the U.S. dollar in October of 2018. And here's a news clip from RT on October 17th, 2018, addressing this.
Moving on to our top story this hour, however, we look to Venezuela, which announced this week it will drop the U.S. dollar in trade transactions. Venezuela's industry minister, Tarek Alassami, made the announcement Tuesday, saying the country will no longer submit to any monetary domination as U.S. intervention.
All transactions in the domestic exchange market will be referenced using the euro and other convertible currencies. We return to the scheme of the euro. The best help they can give the people of Venezuela is that imperialism pulls its murderous and criminal claws out of the country and let us be free. We will not be anyone's colony again.
And if you had any doubt that the U.S. is actually after Venezuelan oil, here's National Security Advisor John Bolton confirming it.
Well, we're in conversation with major American companies now that are either in Venezuela or, in the case of Citgo, here in the United States. I think we're trying to get to the same end result here. You know, Venezuela is one of the three countries I call the troika of tyranny. It'll make a big difference to the United States economically if we could have American oil companies really invest in and produce the oil capabilities in Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of Venezuela. It'd be good for the people of the United States. We both have a lot at stake here making this come out the right way.
Under President Bush, when we were attacking Iraq, we had the axis of evil, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. And now, John Bolton just talked about the troika of tyranny. And that troika is Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela. So U.S. aggression is not just aimed at Venezuela. And as you already know, one of the ways that the U.S. government creates regime change in order to install a puppet government under its control is to use economic sanctions. Another way is to create and fund NGOs, but we'll get to that later. Economic sanctions are a form of war with devastating effects on the local people. And here's journalist Abby Martin of Tele Sur on RT's John Papantonio's program discussing news censorship and sanctions on Venezuela.
U.S. sanctions against Venezuela have intensified under the Trump administration, and these sanctions have not just weakened the country's economy, but they've also deprived millions of viewpoints questioning U.S. policies abroad. As a result of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela, shows like The Empire Files with Abby Martin, a show that's released more than 100 documentaries, interviews, and on-the-ground exposés, has been forced to shut down production completely. We're joined by journalist Abby Martin to get the complete story. Abby, talk about the latest sanctions against Venezuela and why your show's been shut down as a result. I got to wonder, you know, is there more to this story? I can't help but think there is. What's your take?
Yeah, so just some quick background. I mean, even though the Bush administration was instrumental in that coup against Hugo Chavez in 2002, where they kidnapped him and shut down Telesur, sanctions weren't actually implemented against Venezuela until the Obama administration in 2015. Oddly enough, a country with the largest oil reserves in the world was randomly declared a unique national security threat from Obama. But Telesur was still able to function under those sanctions. It wasn't until the Trump administration, which really, really narrowed its focus on reinstalling hegemony in the region of Latin America that kind of got out of control during the Bush and subsequently Obama administration, that he really implemented draconian sanctions. And he kept escalating these sanctions, Pap, until the latest round completely seized Telesur's ability to function. And this was right after the Democratic re-election of Maduro in this landslide victory. And the U.S. penalized the Venezuelan people for the punishment of voting and electing the wrong candidate, according to the U.S. So what those sanctions have done is exactly as they are intended to do. They hurt the most vulnerable and poor people of any designated country. And so what we're seeing in Venezuela is, of course, the poorest of the people are not able to get food and medicine access. And of course, that reason is used to exacerbate even more sanctions. But unfortunately, one giant collateral damage of the latest round of sanctions is to completely seize all operations of Telesur. So all contract journalists for the last 6 months have been unable to receive funds all around the world. And even though Telesur is funded by actually five Latin American countries, all of those countries' ability to transfer funds in and out through Caracas have also been completely halted, Pap. So we're left kind of wondering what's next here. And if this is some sort of a larger operation going along with the whole online censorship coordination with these tech giants and the U.S. government here.
So many foreign organizations simply trying to tell stories that corporate media in the United States can't tell. They can't tell the stories because their advertisers forbid them from doing that. You got a guy like Andy Lack, who I call Andy Lackey, up there, for example, with NBC. Whenever an advertiser calls in and says, you know what, we really don't like that story you said you told about the government. We don't like that story you said about that you told about this manufacturer, this corporate entity or Wall Street. Andy Lack and Phil Griffin, as you know, are the first ones to shut the story down. That's not just MSNBC, it's CNN, ABC, CBS, you name it. All of a sudden, we have other alternatives that people can go to and hear stories like you told. There's got to be some connection here. I mean, I would hope that we could better understand what's actually going on in that regard.
There's a reason why people like you, people like me, are work for outlets like RT, like Telesur, because there's very little places, virtually no places, obviously, in the corporate media apparatus, that you can tell the truth to challenge corporate tyranny and this U.S. imperialist narrative of constant regime change all around the world. We're told who our enemies and our allies are, cartoonishly by the corporate media. So that's why I'm with Telesur, and I'm very proud to be with Telesur. And Telesur was actually created as a joint project between Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro to challenge that corporate media hegemony that was basically confronting their countries and trying to install regime change in them over a decade ago. And Telesur has actually been a constant source of attacks and threats from the U.S.-backed opposition in Venezuela over the last decade plus. There was even a coup plot that involved bombing the headquarters of Telesur back in 2015. That was foiled. So yes, I think that, you know, days after this assassination attempt of Maduro that was actually turned out to be linked to Miami and Bogota, evidently. Days after that, you saw Venezuela Analysis, which is an independent alternative outlet that has nothing to do with the state, being shut down by Facebook arbitrarily. You saw Telesur being shut down by Facebook arbitrarily, reinstated later, but for bizarre, ambiguous reasons. And this is after the sensitive content bans, the age restrictions already on Telesur's videos and our videos. So, Pap, I think that this is part and parcel with this larger operation of these tech giants working hand in glove with CIA stacked think tanks like the Atlantic Council that are literally curating our reality and trying to paint anything that challenges this establishment narrative as conspiracy theories, as disinformation, as Russian trolls. The methodology is a black box algorithm that we can't actually determine what is actually going on. How are these people determining what can be backpaged on Google? Why these algorithms restrict leftist content. So it's a very dangerous and slippery slope that we're on. And I just think it's time that, you know, we take a step back and actually fund the journalists that we want to see and want to support. Unfortunately, that's the state that we're in with this abysmal media consolidation in the U.S.
And here's Lee Camp again on his show Redacted Tonight, discussing CNN's coverage of the sanctions.
But CNN wasn't done.
In the capital, there's a queue for everything, everywhere. Hunger breeds a special kind of anger.
We have devastating sanctions on them! We're helping create that hunger! This isn't to say Maduro has done an awesome job, but whether he has or not, we're not fucking helping, all right? Saying we must sanction them to help them is like if somebody, like, fell through a plate glass window and he's bleeding and you go, let's help him. Let's start cutting out the glass with this rusty flathead screwdriver. But that's what our sanctions are designed to do. They're designed to hurt poor and average people the most. Back when Rex Tillerson was Secretary of State, he publicly said, we could tell our sanctions on North Korea were working great because poor fishermen were washing up on the beaches starved to death. Yay! Yeah. We saved them by starving their poor people.
There's a national march on Washington on March 16th called Hands Off Venezuela. It starts at noon in front of the White House. And you can learn more about that event at the website popularresistance.org. And that's a great site for a lot of information. So popularresistance.org. And I'll end the show today with these sentiments from journalist Abby Martin.
Going to Venezuela firsthand made me realize how much the media is lying to us about the reality on the ground. The U.S. government and its propaganda arms say it's a dictatorship where mass famine and civil unrest demands U.S. intervention. They deliberately don't tell you key facts. An economic war being waged inside by private businesses and outside of the country by crushing U.S. sanctions. Trump's sanctions have debilitated the Venezuelan economy, costing them $6 billion just in the last year. And sanctions do exactly as they're intended to do, by hitting the poor and working class people the hardest. Their strategy is to starve the people into submission, then cynically use that humanitarian crisis as the premise for more intervention. They say that millions of people are demanding the ouster of Maduro. What they deliberately don't show you are the millions who support Maduro, who voted for him, who are also in the streets protesting this criminal coup attempt. They say that a coup is democracy. that Guaido is restoring the Constitution by declaring himself president in a country that just held a presidential election last year. We've seen this propaganda playbook before, from Latin America to the Middle East, and it's literally being led by the same war criminals. John Bolton, who lied us into war with Iraq, Elliot Abrams, who facilitated a genocide in Guatemala. 1 million Iraqis died for a war based on lies, paved by the so-called free press. And they're doing it again. All progressives and anti-interventionists have to stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Venezuela to defend their sovereignty and let them decide their own future, free from U.S. sanctions and intervention. We must call this what it is, an illegal coup underway by the bloodthirsty Trump regime to overthrow one of the last remaining independent nations in Latin America and plunder their oil. Trump has already threatened military intervention. Millions of lives are at stake. We need your voice now to speak up and speak out against another U.S. war for oil. Hands off Venezuela.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
And this is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Well, we the people must break the old taboo on U.S.-Israeli relations and Washington's permanent acquiescence in Israel's illegal colonization of Arab land. We must condemn Israel's unrelenting violations of international law, continued occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, home demolitions and land confiscations. We must cry out at the treatment of Palestinians at checkpoints, the routine searches of their homes, and restrictions on their movements.
Americans should question the U.S. government funds that have supported multiple hostilities and thousands of civilian casualties in Gaza, as well as the $38 billion the U.S. government has pledged in military support to Israel. We must condemn Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital and his recognition of Israeli claims to the Golan Heights.
Governments today are waging a war against the people, whether through securitization against asylum seekers in fortress Europe, counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, or the subliminal war of policing and surveillance arising everywhere. And Israel's contribution to this is a key, exporting the high-tech weaponry, security systems, and methods of pacification designed for and tested on the residents of Gaza.
Our guest, Jeff Halper, explores these technologies of control, which blur the lines between the military, domestic security agencies, and the police, and reveals Israel's pivotal role in the worldwide suppression of human rights.
Jeff Halper is the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and a Nobel Peace Prize nominee. He's the author of War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. And now, on the ground from Tel Aviv, Jeff Halper.
Jeff, your latest book, War Against the People, flesh out the issues which are strategically important as it influences world communities and the issues of our own repression and militarism.
You know, I'm the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. I'm getting pushed around by soldiers that I'm getting arrested. How does Israel get away with this? Massive violations of human rights, brutality. Israel's demolished 55,000. Palestinian homes in the occupied territory since 1967, on the southern border of Europe, in the Holy Land, no less. How does Israel get away with this? I can't really understand it looking down. Let me look up at Israel's role in the world. Israel, small, it's true, but a highly sophisticated high-tech industry with 125 years fighting war against the Palestinian people. Israel has, more than almost any other country, the weaponry, the tactics, the conception of war against the people that is missing in a lot of countries. Israel exports arms and surveillance systems and security systems, not just to militaries, but to security forces and police forces all over the world. You can go to country by country by country and show how Israel helps its elite, its government, to suppress their population. If they're dictatorships or if there's tremendous economic disparities like in the global south, but also in the global north. Max Blumenthal wrote an article about how the Occupy camp here in New York City was dismantled according to Israeli police tactics. And again, this program of Jewish Voice for Peace, Deadly Exchange, shows how the Israeli police forces are training the American police forces. You can go country by country and show Israel's role. But there's another level that's even more surprising, and that is that we all live in a capitalist system, everybody in the world. And it's a neoliberal system that's closing down more and more on people. 80% of humanity lives on less than $10 a day. The middle-class kids in the global north don't have the prospects of attaining the standard of living their parents had. As the system starts to close down and you have resource wars and the planet is dying in many ways, this capitalist system has to become more violent, more repressive. The United States does not have the arsenal to fight wars against the people. It doesn't know how to fight wars in New York City or wars in Afghanistan, for that matter, or Vietnam. The only highly sophisticated Western country that is geared towards wars against the people is Israel, the go-to state for that kind of warfare. Interstate warfare is a thing of the past. The last major interstate war, conventional war, that involved two or more major powers was a Korean War. Those kinds of wars are a thing of the past, and now we've got wars, and there's 100 terms for them. Asymmetrical wars, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, low-intensity conflicts, hybrid wars, irregular wars. I mean, there's a lot of terms. Down to homeland security, militarized police. So what's happening here is you can see the police are being militarized and your armies are being policified. Because rather than fighting wars, they're sent to repress populations. Not to fight armies, but to repress populations like in Afghanistan and Iraq and Africa. This new kind of warfare, the cutting edge of warfare, which is what I call securocratic war or war against the people, that involves not only armies, but domestic security and police forces that are all becoming one package today, is in many ways guided by Israel. Israel has a laboratory. If you look at the occupied territories, not as a threat to Israel, but as a resource, you've got millions of people that you can experiment on. There's 600 checkpoints in the West Bank. Millions of Palestinians passing every day. No wonder Israel secures the New York airport. No wonder Israel's world's leaders in biometrics and facial recognition and surveillance systems, because it's got all these Palestinian guinea pigs to test its technologies out on. You can't explain the disproportionate attacks on Gaza by the whole Israeli arsenal on this little tiny place with no army by the actual military threat of these primitive Hamas rockets. The only way you can explain it is that Gaza is being used to experiment with new weapons. I document what new weapons are used for the first time in Gaza. Israel is keeping intentionally a kind of a low-intensity conflict going with the Palestinians, because that's the laboratory. But the goal is to export that weaponry, to export the occupation. Israel has a concept of a security state that's trying to export, in which Israel says you can be a democracy, but democracy has to be subordinate to security. I won't get into that whole kind of a thing. The Palestinians are not the object of the Israeli military. They're simply the guinea pigs. The point of the Israeli military and security and these attacks is to develop weapons that can be exported to the United States. So you're really the ones that are the receiving end of these weapons, not the Palestinians. You're being Palestinianized as your police forces are being Israelized.
As the Democrats and the Republicans joust here, whether it's a concrete wall of, or right. it's yeah, high tech,
yeah, yeah,
to right. what extent would you consider that to be capitulation of the Democratic Party
right.
to be dealing with just that, which is picking up those very techniques and technologies that are being exported,
right.
some of them which already exist on the border here
right.
are actually used in football stadiums and other places
right.
to surveil right. the American populace.
The Democrats are saying you can have border security without a wall because you have the technologies. You've got sensors. You've got automatic.
That's exactly what they're saying.
And so Elbit Systems, which is an Israeli security company, together with Boeing, were the two major companies that came together that were building this, what they call a smart fence on the Mexican border. Trump comes in with the wall idea. The wall idea is stupid. You really don't need a wall because you've got these technologies that they can both detect movement. It's called aerial denial, either through different kinds of noises or gases or even automatic shooting. They can keep people away from the border. There's all kinds of technologies. It's called area denial technologies. Elbit Systems and Boeing have those technologies. They can build that wall. But that simply goes with what I'm saying, is that Israel plays a key role. Somebody wrote an article and he called that border the Palestine-Mexican border because it's the same technologies. Israel is exporting these securitized borders all over the world. So if you look at a map of the global north and where the borders are, you know, with Mexico and then between Europe and Turkey and Europe and Eastern Europe even, Europe and Africa, North Africa, all these borders that separate the global north and the global south, you'll find Israeli impose on that map these securitized borders that exist. You'll find Israeli-inspired high-tech fortifications and barriers that demarcate the border between the global north and the global south. This is really a global, I mean, Israel is involved in a global campaign of pacification. Subtitle of my book, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. And that is that the capitalist elites want to pacify us. Pacification means suppressing us to a point where we can't resist. And it's using all kinds of technologies of suppression. And then on top of that, the idea of security. Because security is a very subversive idea. You know, you want security. Everybody wants security. So I want my government to bring me security. So what it does is it hides the interests of who's trying to secure you. You know, and you end up pacifying yourself. So I say, for example, what if we substituted the word pacification for security? And I want to be secure, okay? Do I want to be pacified? Oh, all of a sudden, questions start to rise. The question is, who's pacifying me?
Well, exactly.
See, nobody asks who's securing me. You go to the airport and it's clear. The government's securing me because of terrorists. But if you ask the question, who's pacifying me? Why are they pacifying me? How are they pacifying me? The word pacification brings up critical issues that the word security suppresses. So security becomes a very useful term in getting people not to see what they're being secured against, who's securing them, and you end up securing yourself. In Europe, for example, you don't take off your shoes in airports. You don't take off your belt. In Israel, you don't take your computer out of the bag. There is no reason why you have to do those things in the 21st century. The reason they're done, if they are done there, is because the Americans don't like to certify airports unless they do it the way Americans do it. And the Americans, I think, want to pacify their own people. So you can tell Americans in airports in Europe because they're the ones walking around with no shoes. You know, the Europeans don't do that. So in a sense, we're pacifying ourselves. We go to the airport and take off our belts, take off our shoes, take off our watches. We do more than they even ask for.
And the political implications of pacification, let's talk about the conclusions of that. What is the function of the state? What does this mean for our civil liberties and rights? And, and talk a little bit more about some of the ways in which this is happening and some of the entities that are involved in this incredible technology that is being exported.
Part of it is surveillance. You have systems today that are total. For example, Israel has a chip and it's trying to sell it to LAX and other airports. You can put a chip between your thumb and your finger.
Mm-hmm.
And with that chip that has your profile and there's algorithms and all that kind of stuff, you can walk into an airport, put your bag down, and walk right to the plane. Nobody's going to bother you. Unless you don't fit into a certain profile. The technology is there that just lets you go. In order for this to work, you have to do ethnic profiling because you have to have an algorithm that tells you who can pass and who can't pass. And you do that according to ethnic background. You know, it's a profile of who a terrorist is and who the problematic people are. In order for this technology to be adopted, you have to change the laws of the United States that forbid ethnic profiling and racial profiling. So that's an example of the contradiction between a security state and a democracy. Democracy says we're willing to take the risk of a terrorist going through, or we're willing to take the bother to check every single person so that we're not profiling. We're willing to do that because we don't want to profile particular people. Versus the security argument, like Israel says, is stupid. Why are you looking at this at the 80-year-old person in the wheelchair? Why is a 6-year-old boy got to put his hands up in the X-ray machine? You know they're not the terrorists. You know who the terrorists are. So focus on them. Which means then, you know, which is true from a security point of view, but it means ethnic and racial profiling that undermines the civil liberties of people. So it just shows you that fundamental contradiction between the security state that Israel's trying to push, where security dominates everything, and a democracy in which, you know, you try to deal with security, but the most secure countries in the world are totalitarian regimes. So that just gets at one kind of area of tension. I mean, the whole thing of militarized police. That's very effective if you want to prevent crime and terrorism, but it's at the cost of your civil liberties.
And those core, which I know is one of the titles or certainly tables in your book that looks at the core Israeli military export technologies. Tell us about some of those.
Israel exports almost on every level. But again, what I'm trying to show is that it's really the police and the security that domestic, that's the focus. In the West, in the United States and Europe, there's a real distinction between civilian and military. You know, FBI and CIA and so on. We keep those firewalls. What Israel's trying to do is to put them together. And I found, for example, that if you take the military and domestic security and policing as one package, globally, it's a $2.5 trillion a year industry. You can imagine the economic interests and political interests of a $2.5 trillion a year industry that we on the left know nothing about. I even warn people in my book, the middle of the book is going to be boring because I'm going through all kinds of military technologies, laser.
You're the only author I've ever heard say that. But.
No, laser, nano. You know, micro heaters for area denial.
Actually, quite the contrary. That is so not boring. That is so for the course
today. No, for a lot of people. Because we don't know those technologies. And the left, you know, most of us on the left, I would say, come from the social sciences, the humanities, the arts. We don't know the hard technologies.
But our youth communities live with, and it's a strategic part of their existence, technology.
Who? All of
our youth from the age of 5 up. Every single cell phone, you know, every game that they play.
Yeah, but that's not technology in that sense. On the contrary, what you have more and more, C.P. Snow wrote about this in the 50s, you've got universities that have science libraries over there and humanities social science library over there. They have separate campuses even.
Right, but I would debate that we're technologizing faster and it is really par for the course. And I think that's part of the issue, actually, of the exportation of these things, that there's a receptivity and it's considered a sophistication. It's like politically, the Democrats don't say, we do not need to fortify our borders.
Right.
That this is an entire political ruse. And it's,
right,
again, creating
that's
otherness.
Right. That's right.
They are, on the contrary, saying, we will defeat your ideological and political strategy, etc.,
right,
by saying that we will use high-tech methodology,
right,
which
that's
is actually
right,
more on par with what we need today to still
right,
the same idea of, quote-unquote, security, or making sure that the other does not have full and complete access
right,
to land, frankly, that was
right,
formerly
right,
theirs. But so, I mean, I'm just wondering how much your book, which I haven't had a chance to
mm-hmm,
read, but definitely will, as
mm-hmm,
all our audience will, The War Against the People, Jeff Halper.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How much do you deal with these kind of contradictions?
I deal a lot with them. One of my main points is that we don't even know the technologies that are being used.
Mm.
I mean, kids play with their cell phones, okay, but we have no idea. For example, everybody's concerned about nuclear weapons. Nanoweapons are much, much more dangerous. I don't know how many people in your audience knows what a nano is. You know, it's a molecular size unit that you can load with artificial intelligence and diseases. You can put anthrax into a molecular size nanobot, it's called. That nanobot, and put in water, in the New York water supply, that nanobot will multiply, self-replicate a trillion times in about 48 hours. And can kill everybody. We have weapons that are so powerful today, and the American government, the Israeli government, the Italians, Chinese, Germans are putting most of their development money in defense into nanotechnologies today. Well, when was the last time you ever heard a discussion of nanotechnology on TV? Nobody knows this. I didn't know it. I mean, myself. I wrote a book about something I know nothing about. You know, I couldn't tell you a grenade from a tank. It never interested me. That's not my thing. But I say to myself, you know, I'm an activist in the world. I don't know anything about a $2.5 trillion industry. I don't know anything about the most dangerous technologies in the world that police can use against me, like nanotechnologies, for example. In other words, there's huge blind spots in our critical way of looking at the world. We're not seeing a lot of the world. And the technologies, we have this naive idea that freedom will always win, justice will win, the good guys, the bad guys. We have no idea what technologies these bad guys have at their disposal.
And is the part of the thesis of your
book
that not only to expose them, but we now have to institute what, an international regulatory system,
yeah,
as we have begun to look at around nuclear weaponry?
Yeah, that, and I'm trying to, I don't get too much into application, but I'm trying to suggest that this has to be a central issue of the left, military technologies and these issues of security and securitization, that it isn't. You know, we once in a while, you know, media, Benjamin, you know, has a book about drones,
mm-hmm,
which is very good. You know, once in a while we'll focus on some military thing that happened. You know, everybody went out, of course, against the war in Iraq. It's very sporadic and very erratic and so on. I don't think this whole issue of military technologies, policing, repression, and the enforcement of global capitalism is at all on the agenda of the left. It's a complete blind spot for us.
And how practical and how real is this at this time? You did talk about certainly the Palestinians being used as a laboratory to develop these technologies. Are they actually in use in any significant number? Or is this...
No, a lot of it's...
Are we being Brave New World here, or...?
Well, no, a lot of it is being tested. It's in use. Nanotechnology is so dangerous that it's even hard to test it because it can get out of control. But there's all kinds of technologies today that are being experimented with that that we're not really aware of, that I, including, you know, with police forces. And
talk about some of the issues of the Israeli training and exportation of methodology that affect policing forces in the U.S., for example.
For example, I was in Georgia State University in Atlanta. I look out the window, and the students say, you see that building there? It's a black cube on campus. No one's ever, we don't know who goes in there. We can't go in there. We have no idea what goes on in there. Nothing. And it's called the Gilley Center. We look it up, G-I-L-L-E-E, which is like the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange Program, something like that, which is where the Israeli police come to train American police forces. Funded by Bernard Marcus, who's from the who started the Home Depot. If you go into the website of the Gilley Center, you'll see all these American police forces in the Israeli police stations in Israel doing training with Israeli police. It's a whole center where the Israeli police and the Israeli police are training the Americans, for example, to look on citizens as terrorists, not as citizens to be protected. It's a whole different approach. And even the weaponry. So the Israel weapons industry, which produces the Uzi submachine gun, which is the most famous submachine gun of all, now opened a factory in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to take Israeli military weapons and reduce them, compress them, so that they can be used by law enforcement officers.
Make them smaller than an
Make
Uzi,
them smaller.
Which is already...
So now an Uzi, which wasn't a very big machine gun,
no, it's very small,
is now at the size of a pistol. The idea is that your police forces can now carry Uzi submachine guns in their holsters. So that's in terms of the weapons that are being used, the militarization of the police, the idea that, again, I think the capitalist idea that most citizens are have to be secured. Because they're unhappy if they're the more and more they're excluded from the capitalist system, like the Occupy kids and like immigrants and poor people and so on, the more you've got to secure them. You know, you fortified communities, gated communities. This is becoming, you know, so countries are beginning to wall them. Look at Israel, it's walling itself. It's a gated country, and then exporting the gates to other parts of the world. So it's both the logic and the structures and the technologies of repression that are being brought into our countries without us being aware of it, under this neutral idea of security, you see. And that's the danger that I try to point out. That's the Israelization process. That's just the name for it. It's not only Israel doing this, of course, but it comes out of the logic of this repressive neoliberal capitalism.
I must recommend strongly that people get Jeff Halper's book, War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. And just maybe to end with this, any kind of an analogy between the walled-off community, which would seem so obvious, in Israel and the walled-off community that certainly Trump sees creating on our southern border.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, again, a lot of the technologies are the same. And I think, the idea of the southern border is simply a part of a global matrix of these fortified borders that are firewalling the global north against the global south. I saw a map of the Pentagon like that. And, you know, the global south, you know, that's where do we get our minerals from? You know, that's the resource wars. But according to the Pentagon map that I have a picture of, what the global south exports is terrorism, criminals, epidemics, you know, and we've got to firewall the global north off against the global south. Well, Israel, first of all, there's an Israeli company called Checkpoint that actually invented the firewall in computers. That's what prevents you from getting viruses and so on. So the firewall is an Israeli concept, and it's being applied in terms of these fortified borders all over the world. This is the global Palestine that I talk about. Palestine, the actual Israel over Palestine is a microcosm of the global north or of the global south.
Well, Jeff Halper, as you continue to organize, thank you very much. Thanks for spending so much time with us.
And you were listening to Jeff Halper, head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and a Nobel Peace Prize nominee, author of War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
We are the only minority group that you can join overnight.
From Overnight Productions.
In the twinkling of an eye, in fact.
Many doctors don't do a good job of dealing with trans patients, like my first endocrinologist, who thought that my trans identity was changeable.
WYBR Buffalo.
Is this Danger Dave?
Yeah.
You're such a faggot, faggot.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Cayman Islands Court orders marriage equality, queer youth examine trans patient care, and David dances into danger on the radio. Those stories and more this week on the first show of the 31st year of This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 30th, 2019. Marriage equality has finally come to the Cayman Islands. Chief Justice Anthony Smella of the Grand Court issued his ruling on March 29th in a case brought by a lesbian couple declaring that the law defining marriage as exclusively heterosexual is unconstitutional and violates human rights. Chantelle Day and Vicky Bodden-Bush were turned away when they sought a marriage license in April 2018 and then filed a lawsuit. The Chief Justice wrote that the petitioners and their daughter are entitled to the indignities to which they have been subjected being put to an immediate end by the court. This week's decision, said Day, shows that love wins. Attorney General Samuel Bulgin, however, told news reporters as he was leaving the courthouse that the government will have to take some time to consider it and think about how to move forward. The Cayman Islands is an autonomous British overseas territory in the Western Caribbean Sea. With about 60,000 inhabitants on its three islands, Grand Cayman, Cayman Brac, and Little Cayman, it's now the second most populated self-governing British overseas territory with marriage equality behind Bermuda, which opened civil marriage to same-gender couples last year. Northern Ireland, of course, remains the biggest part of the United Kingdom without marriage equality, thanks to a totally dysfunctional government and the British government's reluctance to intervene.
New laws taking effect this week in the East Asian nation of Brunei include punishing consensual adult same-gender sex with death by stoning. It would also punish Muslims convicted of adultery, sodomy, or rape with the same form of execution. Same-gender sex is already punishable in Brunei by up to 10 years in prison. The new statutes are part of a revised Islamic law-inspired penal code that drew international outrage when they were first announced in 2014. Brunei is ruled by its sultan, Hassanal Bolkiah, who approved the changes. The global outrage included boycotts of several high-end hotels he owns, including the Hotel Bel Air, the Beverly Hills Hotel, the Dorchester in London, and other properties in the UK, Paris, Rome, and Milan. That boycott faded in memory, even as the Sultan gradually enacted more parts of Brunei's full conversion to Islamic law, known as Sharia. But calls for a boycott were renewed this week with the announcement on the official website of Brunei's Attorney General that Sharia will come completely into force on April 3rd. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and several other global advocacy groups have condemned the harsh new laws in the strongest terms. The UK Foreign Office is warning queer British citizens about the potential danger of traveling to Brunei, while Australia has said it's probably okay as long as the LGBTQ person is not in your face out. Other governments are sure to weigh in the coming days. Filmmaker activist George Clooney is leading a number of well-known figures in calling for renewed action in response to the death by stoning threat LGBTQ people in Brunei will face under the new laws. As Clooney wrote in an open letter this week, "I've learned over years of dealing with murderous regimes that you can't shame them, but you can shame the banks, the financiers, and the institutions that do business with them and choose to look the other way." You can find a list of the Sultan's properties at thiswayout.org.
Police raided an LGBTQ community center in the northern Russian city of Arkhangelsk this week. They insisted on inspecting the group's headquarters in a nondescript office building while group lawyers, volunteers, and five visitors were prevented from leaving. While no one from the government has offered a comment so far, authorities probably acted under Russia's so-called no-promo-homo law that criminalizes the promotion of non-traditional sexual relations. Vladimir Putin signed the law against gay propaganda in 2013. There's been a steady rise in anti-queer violence ever since. The law has most often been used to deny requests for or to shut down LGBTQ pride marches. A spokesperson for the Arkhangelsk LGBTQ Center, known as RAKURS, said the police told them that their investigation this week was based on an unexplained complaint about the group. RAKURS was one of the LGBTQ groups on the Russian government's list of foreign agents in 2014 and was fined 300,000 rubles when the Putin administration decided that any group supporting human rights for LGBTQ people was clearly representing some sort of foreign ideology. But in response to this week's raid, the RAKURS spokesperson told the Barents Observer that lawyers for the group are ready to defend it, again, in court. It's been holding lectures, organizing seminars, and offering psychological and medical counseling for more than 10 years, and may be one of the oldest groups of its kind in Russia.
A U.S. appeals court this week lifted the final hurdle to the implementation of Donald Trump's ban on military service by qualified transgender people. While lawsuits challenging the policy are still making their way through lower courts, injunctions in four of them had prevented the Pentagon from moving forward on the policy. The Supreme Court struck down two of the injunctions, and a third district judge lifted his injunction based on the Supreme Court action. The D.C. District Court had maintained that its fourth injunction still stood because a final order of the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit on the case, which had struck it down in January, had not been issued. But a three-judge panel of the D.C. Appeals Court issued its final order this week. This means, barring a last-ditch final appeal to the full court, that an estimated 13,700 transgender service members out of a total of about 15,000 will be kicked out of the U.S. Armed Forces on April 12th, and other openly trans people will not be able to enlist. Defense Department officials insist that it's not a ban on transgender service members, but the new policy allows a trans person to serve only if they do so in their birth gender and vow not to transition while serving. Meanwhile, the Democratic-controlled U.S. House, led by Speaker Nancy Pelosi, approved a bipartisan resolution this week opposing the ban and the flawed scientific and medical claims upon which it is based. Five Republicans joined all the Democrats in a vote of 238 to 185.
In other news, global online giant Google has bowed to pressure from LGBTQ groups and other human rights groups and removed an app that purports to help people change their sexual orientation. The last straw for Google this week was apparently falling from the Human Rights Campaign's list of companies with a perfect corporate equality index score. Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon have already removed the Living Hope Ministries Gay Cure app for violating terms of service. It was still available to Android Google users until this week. The Texas-based Ministries claims that same-gender attraction is a sexual sin and calls it a sickness, an addiction, and a destructive lifestyle. Nearly every mainstream mental health organization, certainly in the Western world at least, rejects the claims of its proponents and considers so-called conversion therapy to be a danger to a patient's mental and physical health. The Trevor Project, a suicide prevention group serving LGBTQ youth, applauded the move in a statement that said, in part, that "we are glad Google has joined the rest of the technology sector in its rightful rejection of the dangerous and discredited practice which harms LGBTQ youth we serve each day." More than 140,000 people signed a Change.org petition calling on Google to pull the app from its Play Store. According to GayStar News, a separate petition calling on Apple to restore the app has, at last count, 47 signatures.
And finally, you might recognize Norwegian Airlines for its distinctive tail fins, which portray the likeness of different trailblazing historical figures who have pushed boundaries. Notables already featured include Roald Dahl, Henrik Ibsen, and Greta Garbo. The airline, which operates in all the Nordic countries, along with Spain, France, England, Ireland, Scotland, Argentina, and the U.S., announced the newest addition to its Tail Fin Heroes fleet this week. He'll be smiling on the airline's newest Boeing 787-9 Dreamliner, which is based in London. But the service was set to launch on March 31st in San Francisco, the New York-born honoree's adopted home. The airline has already feted queer icons Freddie Mercury and Oscar Wilde. Have you figured out who the new tail fin hero is? A Norwegian Airlines media statement said that Harvey Milk is being honored for bravery and courage that will span the globe for years to come, reinforcing our joint commitment to making the world a smaller, friendlier, and more inclusive place. Stuart Milk, Harvey's nephew and co-founder of the Harvey Milk Foundation, celebrated the news. "We look forward to seeing Harvey flying into airports across the globe," he said, "and continuing to spread his message of acceptance."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending March 30th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazor, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
Welcome to the wonderful world of being who you really are. It sucks. Big time.
David and his doppelganger discover how to not suck later in the program.
We go to the doctor.
A doctor can be a formidable adversary, no matter how mature you think you are when you walk into the office. Many trans teens find themselves bringing an apple to a knife fight. We'll tell you about how some healthcare professionals are trying to address the issue, but first, one of Outcasting Overtime's queer youth commentators talks about the harm a bad doctor can do.
This is Outcasting Overtime from Media for the Public Good, producer of Public Radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Hi, I'm Dhruv, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Andrew talks about a bad experience with a doctor.
When I was 15, I discovered that I had abnormally high testosterone levels for someone assigned female at birth. This happened after the blood supply to one of my ovaries was cut off, causing it to swell to about 8 inches long. When the ovary was removed, my testosterone levels went back down to what they were before, a medically normal level. But I'm a trans male, and I wasn't so happy about that. I wasn't out yet at the time, but I was fully aware by then that I was trans. My endocrinologist, whom I had started seeing just before my surgery, began to pick up on the fact that I was unhappy about my testosterone levels going back down and began to suspect that I was trans. Because I wasn't out to anyone, this was a very stressful and confusing situation for me. Rather than trying to have a straightforward conversation with me about my gender identity, the doctor dropped hints about it without ever addressing it directly, and spoke cryptically. She spoke to my mom a lot privately, with me in another room. Based on what my mom later told me, I suspect they were discussing my gender, but I was never sure exactly what was going on. Because I wasn't out, I was afraid to ask her directly about it, especially because I wasn't sure if she actually knew or if I was just being paranoid about being found out. This indirect discussion of my gender made it feel like a shameful taboo, something to be hidden. The doctor's lack of straightforwardness with me made me afraid of being straightforward with her. Then the situation got even worse. Scans showed that I was developing more ovarian cysts, and so the endocrinologist prescribed me with birth control containing estrogen. This is a common treatment for ovarian cysts, but not, as I would later discover, the only possible one. At my appointments, the endocrinologist discussed how the estrogen might supposedly treat or fix my gender identity. She repeated that she hoped the estrogen would resolve, as she put it, these feelings you're having, referring to my gender dysphoria. This made it clear that she didn't see my gender as legitimate, which made me feel rejected and dehumanized. And taking estrogen affected my body in ways that I did not want, making me feel like I was losing control. I already had gender dysphoria, which can make my relationship with my body very distressing and frustrating, and having to take female hormones made that so much worse. Back when the endocrinologist first prescribed me with birth control, I told my mom I didn't want to take it. Since the endocrinologist assured us that it was medically necessary, we came to a compromise. I would take the birth control but skip the monthly placebo that causes most people who take birth control to still have periods. The doctor didn't approve of this. Going forward, she began to insist that this decision was bad for my sense of gender because I wouldn't get used to being a girl without getting periods. She also insisted that it was bad for my physical health, but she was vague about why. As far as my mom and I could tell, this isn't true. Taking birth control continuously isn't uncommon, and no other doctor or source I've found says that it's unhealthy. Ultimately, I left this endocrinologist over this, in addition to a couple of other concerns that caused my mom to lose trust in her. I started seeing a new endocrinologist after this. By this point, I was out to a couple of people, so I told my new endocrinologist I was trans from the start. Unlike the other doctor, she had respectful, open discussions with me about my gender identity and my wants and needs for my body. Instead of birth control, she prescribed me Lupron, a drug that suppresses sex hormones. It works as a treatment for ovarian cysts by blocking sex hormones, and it's also commonly used as a puberty blocker for younger trans kids. And because it works to suppress estrogen, a sex hormone, it keeps me from getting periods or developing further feminine secondary sex characteristics as I wait to start testosterone. This was a great temporary solution for both my medical needs and my gender needs, and it came about because my doctor was willing to take my gender seriously and tailor my treatment to my situation. Seeing this new doctor gave my experience with my old doctor new perspective. The old doctor had told me that taking estrogen was medically necessary for me, so I had accepted that the damage it caused to my body was something I had to endure. Finding out that there were other solutions that didn't change my body in ways that I didn't want made it incredibly frustrating that I'd had to spend a year taking estrogen. My first doctor should have treated my gender identity as legitimate, like my second doctor did. She should have had an open discussion with me about what treatment options would have accommodated my needs and wants for my body. Instead, she took advantage of the fact that I wasn't yet ready to stand up for myself. Many trans people, especially those who medically transition or want to, end up interacting with the medical system a lot. Unfortunately, though, many doctors don't do a good job of dealing with trans patients, like my first endocrinologist, who thought that my trans identity was changeable. If doctors lack understanding of what it means or what it's like to be trans, they can end up mentally and physically damaging patients who need their help. I'll never get back that year of my life that I spent taking estrogen, and it's taken a lot of time for my self-esteem to recover from the way that doctor treated me when I was at my most vulnerable and insecure. If more doctors are better educated about trans people and our needs, more doctors can fulfill the purpose of their jobs, making people's health better, not worse.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization that produces public radio's LGBTQ youth programs. Our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
There are doctors who are looking for ways to improve their treatment of young transgender patients. A recent conference on the issues was co-hosted by two UK trans groups and the University of Bristol. Healthcare professionals from both sides of the pond clashed over questions about when and how to begin hormone therapy. UK physicians also noted the problem of the nearly two-year waiting list for treatment through the National Health Service, a wait caused by the insufficient number of doctors with training in the field.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
Time for my personal favorite part of the show. We have some very special listeners out there who I think deserve a ring-a-ding-ding from Danger Dave. WYBR Buffalo.
Is this Danger Dave?
Yeah?
You're such a faggot, faggot.
Thanks for listening. I'll send an autograph.
A movie about queers on the radio? What could be closer to our hearts? Hopefully, entertainment correspondent John Dyer V and the rest of us at This Way Out are not quite as neurotic as the central character in The David Dance.
Welcome to the wonderful world of being who you really are. It sucks. Big time.
Pity poor Danger Dave Patrone. He seems to have a problem with expressing himself. That is, it's a problem when he isn't being Danger Dave, who really isn't actually dangerous at all. But he still has a problem. The David Dance, directed by April Winnie, does go back and forth in time. A bit confusing at first, but soon a kind of ping-pong rhythm emerges. Danger Dave is the host of a Buffalo, New York radio program, and you probably don't have to guess what the show is about.
Gay Talk. You're the guy from Gay Talk. Donna, look who we have here. It's Danger Dave.
It does pretty well, despite Dave's not remembering who his show sponsor is, especially when he has to speak his mind on an issue. Then Dave's natural reticence, almost a pathological timidity, goes away, and we get to hear from an intelligent, thoughtful, and common-sense-spouting gay man. So dangerous. Dave relates, "When I'm alone in the studio, I feel safe. I can say what I want." The peril, at least the emotional peril, seems to encompass Dave more than anyone, as almost everyone else we meet in this story knows their own mind and has no trouble communicating. Did something happen to Dave? We see Dave's often outrageous older sister, Kate, who proclaims, "That's what sisters do. They gnaw on your brains." Which might be news to some of the other sisters out there. We learn that at 39, Kate has decided to adopt a Brazilian child named Margaret.
Can you help me?
What?
You know, if I need help raising him or her, whatever we decide.
Of course I will.
This, after a series of unhappy marriages, is something she feels adamantly sure of. It is certainly a long way from the time of her first wedding, where she was bulldozed into wearing a traditional wedding dress, despite her fervent avowals to shun a traditional ceremony. Will Kate successfully complete her adoption?
I'm Chris, your new technical assistant for the next few months.
The third character in this dramatic triangle is Chris, Dave's cute and amiable tech assistant on their show at WYBR. Chris professes to be a really big fan of Dave's, and he later exhibits the patience of Job when dealing with David's constant inability to decide, to speak, and to act. Their first kiss comes only 50 minutes into the story, and there were times I honestly wondered if our Dave was either clinically depressed or somewhat autistic. As he admits, it took me a long time to say the word gay. Suffice it to say that Dave would not have gotten very far in life were it not for Kate and Chris, who both exhibit depths of empathy and support that few others would muster. Apart from Kate and Chris, we get short glimpses of Dave and Kate's parents, who are apparently little to no help at all when it comes to being there for their children. Strangely, we never fully see the face of their father. His back is always turned, or else his face is partially obscured. This leaves a lot of room for speculation. Though he is pretty much his own worst enemy, a more obvious antagonist to Dave arrives in the form of ultra-Christian June Hanley, Gainesville, Florida's radio host of Inspire in the Evening.
Larry arranged for you to have another live debate with June Hanley in 2 weeks.
The woman is nuts, so are you.
Your on-the-air persona is really just a cover-up, isn't it? For the anger and deep-seated issues that you really have?
The collision between Dave and June is mostly predictable, with June's character behaving condescendingly unchristian. But the later scene, where June has a private minor breakdown, is most engrossing. So we see Dave at various ages and emotional milestones of his life, including a traumatic incident during his adolescent years. Damn that Stewie Gardarella! While the revelation of what happened is quite unpleasant, we are led to believe that this one incident is entirely responsible for Dave's hunted, almost haunted adult persona. Could it be PTSD? And it is this unsure person, jokingly dubbed by Chris as Sir David, office freak of Buffalo, who ends up facing another, more serious trauma. How Dave decides to handle or not handle this later crisis will affect everyone around him, including young Margaret in Brazil. A funny line about the pending adoption goes, "Well, some people might find bringing an orphan child from poverty to Buffalo redundant." Don Chimay portrays David, and the film is based on his own stage production of the same name. Mr. Chimay co-produced the film, and the spot-on original music is by Mark Jackson. The supporting cast, including Guy Adkins, Antoinetta LaVecchia, and Jordan Baker, are all strong anchors to a tricky scenario. There are some quirky moments, like an intense revelation scene between Dave and Kate set during their school years. As the action goes back and forth, we sometimes see the adults portraying their younger selves, and sometimes we see different younger actors as the same pair, all in the same scene. It's an odd choice, but it works. Don't we all carry our younger selves into older ages? This also reveals why a traditional linear plotline probably would not have worked as well for this particular story. Despite the sometimes trite dialogue and David's often maddening self-sabotage, we find that Dave, and all the Daves of the world, can still succeed. He advises a young girl who is being harassed and seriously doubting herself, "Don't listen to what people say if it isn't right in your head." Now that is some darn good gay talk.
If you're out there and you're listening, you know who you are. And that's what counts the most.
For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
The David Dance is now available on Amazon Prime and Vimeo On Demand. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Christopher Gall and John Dyer V, produced with Brian DeShazer, Outcasters Drew and Andrew, produced by Mark Sofas, and from John Dyer V. The Indigo Girls performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, John Beaupre, Richard Merck, and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucy Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5PBA Salisbury, South Australia, KAZU Pacific Grove, California, WVEWLP Brattleboro, Vermont, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Central to the national mythology of the United States has been the idea of the limitless frontier, whether territory to occupy, imperial lands to conquer, or markets to dominate. But that notion of unlimited expansion is running up against a wall, argues Greg Grandin, with Trump representing a pivot away from long-standing centrist internationalism. In his latest work, The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America, published by Metropolitan Books, he cautions that this change has significant implications not only for the establishment, but also for the left. Historically, moments of political reform in the U.S., from the expansion of white male suffrage to the civil rights era, have been coupled with some kind of expansion, and this may no longer be possible, even if it were desirable. Grandin is professor of history at NYU and the award-winning author of a number of books, including Fordlandia and The Empire of Necessity. Greg, what is the frontier myth, and what role has it served in American history?
Well, the frontier is both a social experience, the idea of expansion, that the United States, even before its founding, was born in expansion, a ceaseless moving west of settlers moving from Europe to the Atlantic seacoast, and then across the Trans-Mississippi Valley, and then west across the frontier, and then the frontier is also ideology, the way in which that experience was mythologized. It wasn't really until the end of the 19th century with the historian Frederick Jackson Turner that the frontier itself became a word to capture that experience, that to kind of mythologize that social experience. Up until that point, the word frontier basically meant, as it does in other languages and cognates in other languages, frontera in Spanish, it meant a boundary or a border or a military front. But what happened in the 19th century, and we could get into the specifics later on, but as the border itself becomes detached from the frontier, with the Mexican-American War and the establishment of what is the United States' permanent fixed southern border, frontier, the word frontier broke free as an abstraction and came to mean a civilizational zone, a place where white settlement met savagery, where civilization met savagery. It became a kind of a venue of existential self-creation, and came to capture, you know, American exceptionalism means a lot of things, and there's lots of different ways in which it could be defined. But this idea of a nation moving out in the world, moving towards into the future, was came to be represented by the frontier. And you know, we can get into this, but you know, this is not romanticizing the idea of the frontier at all. The frontier, at the same time, was also always a border, the place of dispossession, of indigenous removal, of ethnic cleansing, and military conquest of Mexico. But the frontier itself, though, and the ideology that came to be embodied by that word, could credibly argue that all of the violence and brutality and savagery involved in that process of moving west was cleansed, was whitewashed in a way. It was deracinated. That you could make a credible argument, and frontier ideologues and theorists could argue that the violence involved in expansion west would be left behind. Racism would be reduced to a remnant as the United States became more liberal, more universal, more forward and future looking, and the argument of the book is that that's over. That moment is over.
Well, as you say, the power of the notion of the frontier and the meaning of the notion of frontier took on a special potency over the last, well, more than a century, but just tracing things back to the founding of the United States. How did the myth and the notion of the frontier, how was that
present in the early settler colonial project, and what were the contradictions?
Well, it was present at the beginning. The United States, even before its founding as an independent republic, many of its theorists, what people call founding fathers, understood expansion to be something central to the idea of American freedom. So Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison all understood expansion as solving a number of problems that posed to early Republican theory, the idea of a concentration of political power, a concentration of wealth. Later on, other theorists would talk about the problems generated by industrial capitalism, by the concentration of wealth and the emergence of monopoly power. The idea of expansion was understood as a way of diluting those problems, of being able to maintain a notion of Republican virtue. So somebody like Thomas Jefferson, his very first political tract, 3 years before the Declaration of Independence, was to argue that the right to migrate west was not just a natural right, but the predicate or the foundation or the condition of possibility of all other rights. Saxon freemen were able to escape the kind of grip and establishment of European feudalism by fleeing to the British Isles. Then British freemen were able to escape the kind of sedimentation of ecclesiastical and aristocratic power by fleeing across the Atlantic. So Thomas Jefferson's whole theory of natural rights in many ways was founded on the right to, as he called it, the right to move, the right to escape and set up free societies in new lands. So this was foundational to the very idea of what became the United States, or what became, with a more problematic name for the United States, what became America or Anglo-Saxon America. The idea that expansion would allow for a certain kind of was the foundation and maintenance of a certain kind of freedom, a freedom from restraint.
And yet, of course, that freedom from restraint also involved brutal racial subjugation. To what degree was that contradiction? Did that in any way fray the power of this notion of expansion as a means to freedom, or did it somehow bolster it?
Yeah, I mean, the frontier was always at the same time a border, a bloody border, and it did both. One of the arguments of the book is that expansion simultaneously acts as a safety valve, a release, a way of venting contradictions and deferring contradictions inherent in settler colonialism, but then at the same time aggravating them. And you see this over and over and again in U.S. society. The indigenous removal, the dispossession of Native Americans is foundational to the expansion of Jacksonian democracy, the extension of the vote to illiterate, unpropertied white men. You know, which was an unprecedented expansion of the realm of freedom for a certain category of people, was only possible as a result of indigenous removal. Indigenous removal created the material foundation of a kind of unprecedented prosperity and economic wealth, but it also created the kind of lever and safety valve that allowed for the expansion of suffrage without a kind of turn towards class politics. British conservatives, for instance, were constantly often invoked that the frontier is the reason why the United States was able to expand political democracy and without having to worry about an expanded white electorate voting in some kind of class politics, the beginning of a labor party, even though that would be a kind of anachronism. But at other moments throughout this history, you saw the way that expansion both deferred the problem of chattel slavery, where people on all sides of the debate about the question, the relationship of slavery to republicanism, could look to the frontier as a solution, even as expansion west accelerated the drive towards war by turning the United States into two armed camps, one free and one slave, that made civil war the only resolution to the problem of chattel slavery. And it's over and over again that expansion is held up as a problem to as a solution to all of the problems generated by expansion. That's the kind of expansionist premise. And that whole operation can only keep going as long as the frontier remains open and the trauma of past wars, the violence of the extremism generated by past episodes of racial terror involved in expansion could be rolled over into the next episode.
Do you think that the ideology accompanying this expansion and the notion that it could lead to certain passions being redirected away from, say, more radical ideas demanding social justice toward more useful, that is, for those in power, directions. Do you think that that ideology was correct in that sense? Did it, in fact, play that role? When we look at the United States in the 19th century into the 20th century, of course, many people have looked at the history of the U.S. and the history of radical politics in the U.S. and why a Labor Party, for example, never was established. Do you think this actually does serve as part of an explanation?
I mean, I think it does. And this is an old argument that goes back decades to the New Left and even to the progressive era historians and social theorists that looked at the role of frontier played in creating a certain kind of American centrism, a certain kind of American exceptionalism, that in which extremism of both the left and the right, extremism inherent in settler colonialism, the white supremacy, the violence, the racism, but also the extremism of a certain kind of class politics, challenges or trespasses on the right of private property were marginalized, and a kind of frontier universalism was put forward as the highest form of liberal modernity. And it's hard, these are causal arguments. I mean, that it's hard to say. There's many problems that the answer of expansion helps solve. I think it does create a certain, materially, there was a ways in which the push out into the world created the material prosperity that allowed for a mitigation and co-optation of class politics as ideologically in which expansion is used as a way of creating a certain kind of American exceptionalism and sense of uniqueness. There's transactionally in which war is used as a way of distributing resources to create an absorptive, co-optive political system. So I think it's hard to pin down exactly what the mechanism is, the ways in which expansion serves to or has served in the past to allow the United States to avoid this central kind of choice that other nations in different ways confronted. And that was the choice between barbarism or socialism. Frontier universalism marginalized both. Frontier universalism allowed for a kind of vital centrism that marginalized extremism of both the left and the right and allowed the U.S. to avoid having to confront that. And, this is very abstract. It sounds very abstract, but what I'm talking about, you could think about it in terms of political culture and notions of rights. Every other country in the world developed a social rights tradition. Their liberal tradition socialized to a degree where the ideal of a right or individual rights, a right to property, a right to assemble, a right to free speech, was understood to exist in harmony with more active social rights, a right to education, a right to healthcare, a right to live a dignified life. Every other country except the United States, this is I think, the foundation of American exceptionalism, this fetishization of individual rights. And I think that the only way that ideal survives is through this constant history of expansion, territorially across the continent, and then after the end of the 19th century, either through war or through markets.
I'm speaking with historian Greg Grandin. He is the author, among many books, of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So you mentioned earlier Andrew Jackson and the kinds of notions around expansion that he represented. I wonder if you could talk about those ideas and how it fueled a certain romantic notion about expansion at a time when U.S. society was changing pretty rapidly.
Yeah, I mean, Andrew Jackson assumed the presidency in 1828, and he presided over what historians still separate out from the violent process of indigenous removal. They talk about Jackson as a period of boisterous proto-proletarian democracy in which suffrage, the franchise, the vote was extended to white men who didn't own property who were illiterate, and they separated out from the violence of the frontier. But Jackson really was a creature of the frontier. He was involved in processes of Native American, as a kind of Tennessee slaver, lawyer, trader. He was involved in the slave trade down into the Gulf of Mexico in the early 1800s. He made a national name for himself with the destruction of the Creeks, which set the stage for a series of other violent episodes in which he was catapulted to national power, and then he won the presidency in 1828, and the Age of Jackson leads to the foundation of what in many ways is the foundational premise of libertarianism, the idea of a minimal state intervening in as little as possible in the economic realm. But that foundational premise was, the kind of what makes that possible is the racial violence of the frontier.
Tell us what were the circumstances for the official closing of the frontier at the end of the 19th century and its connection to the American expansion outside of U.S. borders?
Well, the U.S. Census Office declared the frontier closed in the 1890s when the population reached a certain density and there was no more quote unquote free land to distribute. This was also the moment in which the Frederick Jackson Turner in 1893 delivers a famous paper, The Significance of the Frontier in American History, at a Chicago World Fair. And that's the essay that in many ways crystallizes the idea of the frontier as not so much a referent to a landed place, not so much as a reference to a border or a boundary or a national or a military front, but more as a line that separates civilization from savagery, as I think Turner used, a kind of the outer edge of the wave. And this was a moment in which Turner was trying to capture. What's interesting about Turner is that compared to other historians at the time, and you think of somebody like Theodore Roosevelt, who would later go on to be president, but he wrote a number of histories about the West, was celebrating the violence involved in expansion. Roosevelt talked about westward expansion as a kind of continuous war dating back from the period of Saxon migration to the British Isles. He Roosevelt talked about the destruction of the Creeks as but one battle in this long, centuries-long war of the expansion of white supremacy, of Saxon supremacy. And he understood the march of civilization, Roosevelt did, as almost a kind of Wolfian, violent struggle against nature, against Native Americans, but also against white people's own base instinct, out of which civilization, the kind of foundations of institutionalism, of law, of trade, would then tame Anglo-Saxonism. The importance of somebody like Turner is that he jettisons all of that. He strips all of that violence and all of that explicit racism out of the foundation story of the United States. And he talks about expansion almost as this kind of passive, almost in the passive voice, being driven forward by commerce, by law, by technology. And it's Turner really that begins to deracinate and in some ways whitewash the experience of expansion. And this is important, and this circles back to your question. What was going on in the 1890s with the landed frontier closed and the United States about to launch itself into the world. And that launch was signaled by the War of 1898, where the United States went to war with the Spanish Empire over the Philippines and the Pacific, over Cuba and Puerto Rico in the Caribbean. And, you know, that kind of bid for world legitimacy, which would take quite a long time to consolidate itself, you know, and it's bound up in the decline of European imperialism and European war. But certainly 1898 is an important moment in which the United States launches itself into the world, can no longer be justified as if it was Louisiana Purchase writ large, that kind of, or the Mexican Secession writ large. And the U.S. had to kind of figure out a way to mute the settler colonial violence inherent in expansion and to emphasize what would be understood as the universalism. And this is what's key about the Turner thesis and the frontier thesis, is the way in which moving out on the frontier is understood as moving into liberalism, as moving into the future, as moving into internationalism. And Turner himself was not. I mean, he went along with the War of 1898, and then he was a close ally of Woodrow Wilson, so he wound up supporting a lot of Woodrow Wilson's more militarist foreign policies. But in general, Turner was a kind of mild progressive. He believed that with the frontier closed, the U.S. would turn back into itself, and would begin to use the experience of the frontier to implement a mild program of social reform through public policy. He thought that the next frontier was the realm of public policy, in which the U.S. would plot a course somewhere between extreme corporatism and what he understood as extreme socialism, European socialism. So this idea of the frontier somehow straddling a middle ground is very much present in Frederick Jackson Turner's writings, and present in the 1890s, at that moment when the United States is about to launch itself into the world.
Well, speaking of aspirations for some kind of social reform, how did the idea of the frontier and of expansion change during the New Deal?
Well, the New Deal is, of course, the reaction to the Great Depression, the reaction to the collapse of the stock market. And many New Dealers, many of the intellectuals and policymakers of the New Deal, from Franklin Delano Roosevelt himself down through his Secretary of Labor, Francis Perkins, to his Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, Rex Tugwell, to his Vice President, Henry Wallace. They were very much steeped in the frontier thesis. And FDR himself took classes with Turner when Turner taught at Harvard, although the story goes that he skipped out on that semester and went sailing in the Caribbean. But he absorbed enough of Turner's writings to be able to use the frontier thesis to both explain the crisis, to both explain why 1929 and then the ensuing Great Depression was different than other crises in the past. Because in the past, I mean, this is FDR's kind of thumbnail sketch of Turner now, because other crises, farmers could just pull up stakes and move on and find more land. They weren't completely subordinated. They weren't completely captured by the market and by wage labor. There was other alternatives, and then FDR was able to say, but you know, he would give a kind of 5 or 10 minute summation of the frontier thesis. And then he'd say, you know, with a wave of his hand, but those days are gone. And they used it to kind of articulate and put forward a new ethos of social citizenship. Not so much a coherent economic policy. There was no, I mean, we don't want to go too deep into the weeds about the New Deal and the policies of the New Deal. But they didn't in any way, real way, entail a kind of turning inward or a kind of rejection of the idea of market expansion. But they did entail this idea that that one, the government had to regulate. So FDR and other New Dealers used the frontier theory to explain why a government that historically hadn't regulated at all suddenly had to regulate and intervene in the economy a great deal. And two, they put forward to talk about a kind of new ethos of social citizenship, of social democracy. They began to attach the adjective social on all of these old Turnerian categories. FDR himself talked about social civilization. They talked about social education, social rights, social democracy, social value had to be captured by a social state and distributed through Social Security. So there was all sorts of ways in which the frontier thesis allowed the New Deal to put forward a kind of more socialized understanding of American political citizenship, which, you know, in retrospect, lasted only so long and hit its own limits and hit its own wall in the 1970s. But when one looks at the trajectory of the United States and the power of that Jacksonian ideal of a minimal state, And the supremacy of individual rights and a political culture that defined freedom as freedom from restraint, it was a fairly radical rupture with that tradition.
Historian Greg Grandin is my guest. We'll return with him after this music break. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking today with Greg Grandin about his book, The End of the Myth, From Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. And that's published by Metropolitan Books. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Grandin teaches at NYU and is the author of a number of books, including Fordlandia and The Empire of Necessity. So You argue, Greg, that war has played a particular role in the mythology of expansion and the political usefulness of expansion in U.S. history. Can you talk about the wars of the 20th century and how they fed into the notion of the frontier?
Well, in 1898, when the United States makes its bid, it launches itself into the Pacific and into the Caribbean and establishes itself as a world power, the frontier had closed. But in many ways, the imagery and the experience and the subjectivity and the mythology of the frontier was then easily translated and transferred and extended to these other venues, in the Philippines and the long counterinsurgency that the United States faced in opposition to its rule, counterinsurgencies in Haiti, in the Dominican Republic, in Nicaragua, were all understood in many ways as expansions of the pacification of the West, and the extension of the frontier. Part of the argument is looking at the way – part of the argument of the book is looking at the ways in which war serves to reconcile political and sectional differences. So that war of 1898 is absolutely critical in bringing together and reunifying the South and the North after the Civil War. Confederates and the Sons of Confederates were involved in the pacification of the West, but it really was in the 1880s and 1870s and 1880s and 1890s. But it really was too early for Confederates to re-enter the officers class. But the War of 1898 became understood in very ringing terms as a moment in which the South was readmitted into the Union, there was a kind of reunification of the North's military and bureaucratic might and the South's militaristic culture of valor and all of those ethics that one associates with a kind of warrior culture. So 1898 is absolutely critical for this, but also all of the counterinsurgencies that follow. And then, of course, I mean, we know about World War One, and then World War Two. War and the military apparatus that goes with war is also central, not just in this kind of sectional reconciliation that I mentioned, but in a country that fetishizes individual rights, in a country that for all of the reasons we talked about, managed to suppress a social rights tradition, it was really the military that becomes the venue for the distribution of in what in other countries are called social and economic rights. It becomes the main venue of social mobility, both for African Americans after 1898 and also for poor whites. It becomes, after World War II, where other countries are openly embracing social democracy and social rights, the United States distributes resources that in other countries are called social rights through the military, through the GI Bill of Rights. We don't have an economic Bill of Rights. We have the GI Bill of Rights. And so there is the experience of war and all of the ideological work that serves in terms of creating a sense of nationalism, of keeping the expansionist premise going. But then there's also the institutional apparatus of war, which in many ways becomes the frontier itself, right? There's no more free land to give out after the 1890s to create this foundation of Caucasian democracy. But the military itself becomes in many ways the function that serves that function. It becomes the primary vector in which resources are distributed and some degree of social mobility is ensured. So this is central, and one of the arguments of the book is that there is no moment of political reform in the United States that isn't tied to expansion and usually war. So the expansion of white suffrage in under Jackson is only possible because of Indian removal. The end of chattel slavery in the Civil War is in some ways purchased through the promise of the pacification of the West, which continues the distribution of land. The progressive movement in the starting in the 1890s and the early 20th century goes hand in hand with that expansionist moment that the War of 1898 inaugurates. During World War I, some suffragists traded their support for World War for Woodrow Wilson's war in exchange for his support for the vote. Some reformist labor unionists did the same thing in exchange for labor reform. You can go down the line up through the Cold War and the Lincoln of civil rights. So really, the ability to expand and also, but specifically through war and militarism, is key to domestic politics. It's key to the establishment of legitimacy and these reform coalitions throughout the long history of the United States, from the Jacksonians up through Bill Clinton and globalization.
Well, speaking of globalization, obviously, when we're talking about the United States, we're talking about the indispensable capitalist country. And I wanted to ask you about the importance of markets and the free flow of capital for this notion of expansion in the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, markets, it's one of the main vectors and of expansion. Once the landed frontier is closed, and the history of that is in very concrete terms is the centrality of the U.S. border with Mexico, and Mexico as the country that was the first country to basically be restructured by U.S. capital after the Civil War. Mexico is the United States' first experiment in liberal nation building, in which a peasant economy is reoriented to export agriculture and resource export. And so the border with Mexico becomes a kind of main axis of the organization of North American capital. So it's not abstract. It's in very real terms that even though the frontier, and what's unique about the U.S. frontier is the way that it serves as a kind of exemplary symbol. All countries have borders, and all countries have what might be called a frontier, but only the United States has a frontier that serves as a model, a kind of serves as a proxy for what is said to be an emancipatory kind of capitalism. So even as the frontier is being ideologized as in effect capitalism, the border with Mexico becomes the main axis on how actually existing North American capital is organized. And this, to jump a little bit ahead to the present crisis, this is the central contradiction of something like NAFTA, right? So NAFTA frees capital and frees commodities to travel at will, but it effectively paralyzes labor. Hand in hand with NAFTA goes the militarization of the border. Those two policies are inextricable. They're linked together. Bill Clinton in 1993 signs NAFTA into law, and then he begins the militarization of the border. What that in effect does is that immobilizes Mexican labor. And so you have – and NAFTA is the crown jewel of this earlier moment of globalization, right? This moment that supposedly Trumpism is a reaction to and against, right? A moment in which, you know, political elites move the world towards a more integration, more openness. But it's not true, right? NAFTA NAFTA saw the freedom of capital and the freedom of commodities in emancipated as never before, completely freed from national restrictions, while at the same time saw this whole apparatus put into place to paralyze and hinder and obstruct the free flow of labor.
I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall and the Mind of America. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So before we get to the present, to Trump and his border wall and what that actually represents, I wanted to ask you about the history of countervailing forces against this notion of the frontier and the expansion and the sort of spilling out of the U.S. into the rest of the world that is tied up with that notion. Trump is obviously occupies our minds, but what would be the antecedents to the anxieties going in the other direction?
Well, I think that Trump just gives name and a new organizing form to these deep currents, what some scholars call race realism, right? You can go back to the 1930s and 1940s, and you can read kind of these theorists. In the book I talk about Claire Booth Luce, Henry Luce's wife, Henry Luce mm-hmm. being the publisher of Time and Life, and he's associated with the idea of an American century. He's understood as an ideologue of the notion of a kind of open and world in which the United States superintends a world economy in which doesn't have winners and losers, but through growth all rise up. Claire Booth Luce was explicitly a racist and white supremacist, and she has a great letter to her husband talking in the 1940s talking about, basically agreeing that the United States should superintend a world economy along with Great Britain, but shouldn't make any pretense that it's race blind, right? it should explicitly be in the name of white supremacy and Anglo domination. She loses that argument, obviously, in terms of the way that the world economy and the Cold War is organized after World War II, at least in ideological terms. But her and other writers at the time prefigured and captured this notion that the idea that the world is, that the frontier is limitless and that the answer to all problems and all social problems is the promise of growth, and that the world and that through growth the world could leave behind its racism and its violence and its overt forms of domination. She explicitly said that was a fantasy, and in many ways that prefigures Trumpism. So one countervailing force is this kind of deep-seated race realism, this deep-seated willingness to talk about Anglo supremacy and white supremacy in open terms as a counter to the mythology of the frontier, to what race realists would understand as what is ultimately a mirage. And I think Trump and Trumpism is a new way of talking about this old way of thinking.
Why do you think, though, that Trump really represents the end of the frontier notion of sort of limitless expansion and growth? Could this not just be the latest iteration of something that you say has long roots? And could we not see, I don't know, the next Democratic president of the Clintonite model saying, let's get back to America's greatness, its presence in the world, let's dust that off and revive it again?
Yeah, I think there's three coordinates or three things that explain the kind of end of the frontier, the end of empire, and the racism that used to be deflected outward, why it turns inward. I think it's the fallout from the war in Iraq, the exhaustion of the neoconservative militarist project, and not just militarism. And the U.S. continues to operate 800 bases around the world and run however many wars it's running, 7 or 8. Explicit wars, Lord knows how many operations and how many countries. The exhaustion of the neoliberal growth model, and again, the institutions and terms of that model are still in place, but it's the ability to use both either the to use either militarism or markets as a kind of legitimating premise, as a kind of ideological response to social problems, to be able to point to growth and say that's going to be the solution to our problem, to be able to channel extremism into these messianic missionary projects. You saw the growth, the explosion of nativism in the United States around the time that Bush's Iraq War started to go south. Pretty much, you could index the spread of the Minutemen Project to Abu Ghraib, and there's many different moments that signal the failure, tactical and moral, of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. But certainly Abu Ghraib kind of captures the torture scandal, captures the ideological bankruptcy of that whole post-war project and order. So it's not so much that the United States doesn't have the institutional and relational foundations of its supremacy. In many ways, they're still intact, and it's unclear what's replacing it. But at least in terms of legitimacy, in terms of ideology, in terms of the way the promise of the frontier or the promise of growth or the promise of some kind of moral mission was used to organize domestic politics, I think that's over. I think that's what Trump represents. And I think hovering over all of this, of course, is the climate crisis, sure, that the world stands on the edge of ecological and systemic collapse. And there's a way that I think Trumpism, it doesn't so much signal a denial of that, but an acceptance of it in some ways, right? There's this sense that in a world that is about to come apart at the seams, we have to kind of buckle down and take care of our own. And our own is a kind of the premise of that, of course, is all of the racism that goes with Trump. Now, of course, to go back to your question, I think that, who knows? I mean, maybe the center could be reestablished. Maybe looking back, it's kind of shocking how much Barack Obama was able to reestablish to stabilize the system, mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't know if the contradictions, if the tensions, if the conflicts could be deferred any longer. It does seem that Trump does represent this kind of a turning point, and the opposition between the frontier and the wall. The frontier as a symbol of moving out into the future, of optimism, of internationalism, and the frontier as this, and the wall as this symbol of crystallizing that race realism and all of the disenchantment that goes with it in very graphic terms.
Well, let me end by asking you the implications, if we are in this moment where endless growth is no longer possible, the notion of the frontier doesn't have the same political power anymore. You have been talking about the implications of that for the forces of the right. What about for the forces of the left and the radical left? You are saying that through U.S. history, real social progress has often been at the cost of some kind of expansionist act that has taken place. Are we at a point where social change, left social change, can happen untethered to that experience of expansion, and therefore is this a moment with more potential in some way?
I mean, I think it is, but it does beg a question. How does a left organize itself if it can't ride on the back of an expansion of national power abroad, right? If it can't trade reform at home for support of some kind. I mean, and we're at a moment in which all of the engines of expansion are so linked to the destruction, are so linked to the degradation of the world. I mean, the fossil fuel industry, the military industrial complex, finance capitalism. There's no, I mean, you know, you could look back at the New Deal and you could see that, you know, for good or bad, there was a consolidation of a kind of labor intensive, capital intensive industrial export sector that provided ballast for reform at home, that at least didn't oppose some socialization of political culture at home and political institutions. It's hard to imagine what would be that sector today, and it's hard to imagine. I mean, institutional inertia and rot is deep. We can cheer the left's attempt to take over the Democratic Party and, you know, wish them all the best of luck and success. But, you know, it's easy to be pessimistic, and it's easy to see the inertia, institutional inertia, and the inability of any reform movement to gain traction and to be able to coalesce with other sectors within the power structure that would allow for some stabilization and some reform. It's hard to see where that would actually happen and take place. But I know.
All right. Well, on that ambivalent note, Craig Randon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Sasha. It's great talking to you.
I've been speaking with the author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America. That's published by Metropolitan Books on againstthegrain.org. You can find a link. Greg Randon teaches for now at NYU and is the author of, among other books, Fordlandia. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.